started here.
Is she here?
Okay, well maybe we'll start with Representative Moore's bill, I believe.
Oh, you're still there?
Okay. Oh, we're waiting for copies of amendments to your bill, Representative Moore.
Yeah,
me too. Well, then we could go.
Okay. Yeah, do we want to start the bill and wait for the amendment here?
Yeah.
Have you?
Oh, my
LA
will do that.
Okay, we're still waiting. We're waiting for a few witnesses, and so we could go ahead and start with Representative Bunn's bill. Ms. Bunn, are you ready? Do you have your amendment?
Not really.
That's it, okay. Next in line.
Madam Chair, you know, I think I can do this without the testifier,
okay.
But I feel a little bit badly for them.
Okay.
They're doing another bill in another committee.
Speaker Kellen, has
don't
it's
have
happening.
An amendment or anything.
Okay, all right. So, Representative Kellen, or Ms. Bell, would you like to move, House Bell? What was it? I so move.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Speaker, committee members, thank you for hearing my bill today.
Madam Speaker, where does this bill go from here?
This bill probably should go to finance for, well, it either could be included in, I don't know, I think this bill is being heard in your committee because it actually would be carried in your committee as well, in your committee bill.
Okay, so then we will hold it
so
for
hold it.
Possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Yeah.
So, all right. Sure. Speaker Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill, known as the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Act, is a bill that would mandate newborn screening hearing. Right now in the state, we have a voluntary system of newborn screening. And what we know about that is that there is just statistically, it shows that there's an underreporting of babies with hearing loss or hearing complete deafness. And to give you an idea about this, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, has ranked Minnesota in the bottom five of the country in early hearing screening detection. And this bill would actually most likely bring us into the top five because making it a mandate at birth that would be paid for by the blood spot, which is the device that is used to screen a number of birth defects. Hearing loss actually is the most common birth defect that babies have, but we don't mandate it. We mandate a lot of other things. And so to give you an idea in the range, I think that the number is around, and I'm looking at Cynthia so she can read my lips as we're doing this. We don't have an interpreter here. That there are about 60 to 64 babies reported with hearing loss or deafness. The number really statistically in Minnesota should look like about 260. And the beauty of early intervention and screening is that if a baby is screened within the first 3 months, actually the first few weeks, that if in the first week of birth we know there's hearing loss, and then in the first 3 to 6 weeks, the family can have early intervention to make some decisions about how they're going to communicate with their infant, whether they're going to do signing, whether they're going to do cued speech, whether they're going to go the route of cochlear implant, whether they can use hearing aids as a device that would help the baby be able to develop normal language, speech, cognitive, and social development. If that happens, there is absolutely no difference between a baby. If the baby is screened early and the intervention happens early, there is no difference for those babies as they grow up and become children and go to school and learn for language, for cognitive, for emotional and social development. However, if early intervention does not happen, say that it happens a year later at the 1-year checkup, or it happens 2 years later. A speech is being developed by in the child, and we start to see the outward speech. What happens is that on average, the reading level of an 18-year-old who's had significant hearing loss or deafness is the third grade. These kids don't catch up if they don't have earlier intervention. And so this is the importance of having the early intervention and screening. We have been through a number of committees. We started in Representative Thiessen's committee. We went to Representative Pawlowski's Government Operations Committee. We have a number of stakeholders who support the bill and would be involved in the board that would oversee this and help create something that would be like a one-stop shop for folks to learn about both the medical, educational, and social development pieces of early intervention of the hearing loss piece. I think I'll turn it over to you if you'd like to say a few things.
Welcome to the committee. And if you just introduce yourself, please.
Sure. My name is Cynthia Whiteson, and I'm Public Policy Coordinator of the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing Persons. Thank you for allowing me to share today and join the speaker in covering this bill, HF 1206. I'm deaf, I can't hear, but I do speak. I can't hear my voice. If I get to stop, just let me know. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think Speaker Anderson Kelleher covered everything very well. She has been one of our strongest advocates in supporting this bill, and we've had a number of other legislators sign on a long list, because they believe this to be the heart and soul, the first step of an entire group of legislation that will enable deaf and hard of hearing children to have the intervention needed as well as their families, so they get even footing early in life as language develops rather than lagging behind and becoming very costly for society when that intervention does not happen. So in the first few months of life, this bill, this mandate can make an incredible difference and save a lot of money. And I think that's all I'm going to say. I don't need to take up any more of your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Thank you. You're both very strong advocates for this legislation, and so this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and
thank
members
you,
of the
Madam
committee.
Chair. Members?
Okay. We're okay. Now we have a quorum. Representative Moll, you might be able to put your amendment on. And that amendment is being passed out. Welcome to your committee, Representative Moll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We have heard this bill before, so I won't repeat all of the arguments for its merit. Just a quick review, however, this is House file. Oh, I need to move my own bill, I think.
Why don't you move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1301.
And Representative Moll, is that
to
made over for possible inclusion, or are you moving it forward to another committee?
Yeah, we'd like to send this to the General Register.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we also have an amendment in front of you. When this bill was here before, we sent it to taxes because there was a provision to exempt the property owners from capital gains tax. In fact, they sold it to the tenants. We weren't able to get a fiscal note on that. The fiscal impact was unclear, and didn't seem to have much interest. The mobile home park owners didn't seem to express much interest in that gesture. So the amendment is removing all the text references to that portion of the bill. and then I have my testifier can speak a little more in detail.
Okay, so let's move H1301A1 to get the bill back into the shape that the author intends. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No?
The second amendment is H1301A3, page 2, line 25, strike at any time and insert within 3 years, and I have a testifier who would like to speak to that point, who was asked a couple times here, Ron Elwood from Legal Aid, who you've all met here in the past. So,
so let's officially have you move the A3 amendment. Representative Moore moves the A3 amendment.
Yep.
And do you want to invite your witness to? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This amendment...
Mr. Allen, did you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. The bill as it is currently configured would have, prior to this amendment, would have allowed the residents to make the offer to purchase the park any time after it had been sold if a conversion were to take place. So if the park was sold tomorrow, whether the next owner wanted to convert a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, they would still have to make the offer. In thinking about this a little further, that just seems like a little much, since the current law requires or limits that right to just 1 year. The problem we wanted to fix was that there's seems to be that folks just hung on to the park maybe for a year and a day and then would sell it and then didn't have to make the offer. But I guess between 1 year and any time, there probably ought to be a better balance struck. And so we felt that the appropriate thing to do was to just go from 1 year to 3 years. And that would seem to be to us a reasonable time within which, if a park was going to be converted, an offer could be made. But beyond that, the owner would not have to offer that park up to the residents for purchase. So we just think it's a fairer provision and makes it more balanced. Happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion or questions from committee members? If not, then the A3 amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the amendment is now part of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have heard this bill already, and so I don't know how much more information the committee would like. I'd be glad to answer any additional questions, or since we've heard a couple of bills since we heard this one, if anybody needs any aspect of this bill refreshed for them, I'd be glad to do that as well.
There are a couple of people in the audience who have requested to address this on this legislation. Mr. Verner and Mr. Gallagher. Are there any others, if you'd raise your hand in the audience, who want to testify either for or against? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and I did testify in opposition to the bill at the last hearing, and we still do oppose the bill, even with the amendment. That doesn't change our position. And I have with me Harry Gallagher, who's an attorney with Lockridge Grindle now, and to just address some issues that the committee hasn't heard about yet related to the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon. Harry Gallagher. I'm an attorney with Lockridge Grindle now in Minneapolis, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to take a brief moment to discuss what I think is a serious problem that has not been brought before the committee yet in terms of the focus of this bill and the impact of this bill. Namely, that this bill and the right of first refusal being proposed by the bill will constitute an unlawful taking in violation of Minnesota and U.S. constitutions by taking a valuable property right from the park owners without providing compensation for that right. It's well established that part of your property right bundle, from bundle of sticks, is the right to freely alienate your property and sell it how you want to and to whom you want. In addition, the grant of a right of first refusal is also a recognized property right. It's a right that a property owner possesses that they can convey for consideration to another individual who would like to have a preemptive right to purchase that property. This bill, by inserting a right of first refusal to the park residents, violates the Minnesota and U.S. constitutions by taking away those two property rights from the park owners. As a result, the bill as drafted, and the right of first refusal in particular, will, if enacted, be in violation of both constitutions and constitute an unjust and unlawful taking of personal or real property for the park owners. I'd be happy to address any questions. I've also brought copies for you of a California Supreme Court case that is squarely on point with the situation here. It involved a ordinance. It involved an ordinance very similar to the right of first refusal being included in House File 1301. The California Supreme Court reviewed that ordinance, and actually the ordinance was a little bit less restrictive than yours. It was they had to exercise the option within 10 days, and found that to be an unlawful taking because there was no compensation provided to the owners for that property right which was being conveyed pursuant to the ordinance. The relevant discussion in the case starts on page 10 of the decision that you've been handed. There are other portions of the case that didn't deal with the right of first refusal. But the similarities between the case, as I said, it's squarely on point in terms of not only the language of the ordinance being in question there compared to the first right of refusal here, but also the constitutions of Minnesota and California are nearly identical in terms of their takings clauses. So I would ask that the committee take this under serious consideration. And as Mr. Bruner indicated, Minnesota Manufactured Housing is opposed to this bill and believes that we should not take any further action on it and that it is violative of both the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Any questions or comments for the witness?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to testify, I'm sorry, I did not catch your name, sir.
Harry Gallagher.
Mr. Gallagher, we see rights of first refusal all the time in real estate transactions in my world. Purchase agreements, lease agreements. I've got two buildings right now where tenants hold rights of first refusal. In the event we decide to sell the building, they would have the first right to match a price that was offered, and we would have to justify that that was a legitimate price and we weren't leading them. Yet you're saying in a draft form here, it's unconstitutional? It's not in my business transaction?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is what I'm saying. The business transaction that you outlined is between two private parties, where you have negotiated at arm's length with the tenant or the residents, whoever it may be, for that right of first refusal. Consideration is given as part of the legal negotiations and part of the contractual process that you're going through. In this case, there's no negotiation between the owners and the residents of the park. In this case, the state of Minnesota would be stepping in, taking away from the park owner those rights, that right of first refusal, that you obviously recognize as being a valued right, both for the owner that they're giving up, and for the people who are negotiating for it. So yes, there is a difference. It's because those are between two private parties and not between the state and a private party.
In the community I've come from, that I am from, is a better way to say it, we have a similar ordinance that does give the owners the right of first refusal. And we've gone through that a couple of times on park closings. And I believe the city charter has put that in the form of an ordinance. And it has been used a couple of different times, not successfully by the homeowners, but it still has gone to the developer because they didn't have the wherewithal to come up with the money. But they did have that opportunity and a hearing before the council in that regard. Are you suggesting that that ordinance is unconstitutional?
Madam Chair.
Gallagher.
Madam Chair, Representative. I'm not familiar with that ordinance.
It's Bloomington.
In Bloomington. I'm not familiar with Bloomington's ordinance, but based on what you're telling me, it could be unconstitutional. The ordinance in question in the California case was a local ordinance. It wasn't a state statute, and that was found to be unconstitutional taking by that local unit of government. So while Bloomington may not have been challenged in court, it's possible that if it was, it would be found unconstitutional.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. If we were to proceed with this, who would probably make the challenge of its unconstitutionality? The seller probably wouldn't, because it creates another buyer for the product he's trying to sell. Homeowners wouldn't, because they would want to exercise the option if they could. Who would step in and cause this to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I think the proper party would be the park owner. It was a right of the park owner to convey to whoever the park owner desires at this point. And by taking that right away, the park owner could, in fact, challenge the statute as being unconstitutional and a taking of their property without compensation.
Madam Chair, but I'm not an attorney, so excuse me, but it isn't going to be unconstitutional until it's tested in court. If we were to pass this, until it's tried, it's not unconstitutional.
Mr. Gallagher?
Madam Chair, Representative, ultimately the Minnesota Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court would be the decision-making body that would decide the constitutionality of this. I wanted to bring the issue before you today, bring the California case before you, because this has been an issue that has been decided by other courts, California being, I think, the one most on point, and it was, in that case, found unconstitutional. And the parallels between what you're doing here and what's supposed to be being done here and the California case are just too close, and I believe that the court would find this unconstitutional. Can I say with absolute certainty that Minnesota Supreme Court would agree with me? If I could, I would be doing very well as an attorney, because everybody would want to hire me.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions, comments? Oh, Representative McNamara. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Denson.
Madam Chair, just real quickly, Representative Peterson has stated most of the items. I just want to make sure everyone understands that this committee does not necessarily make law based on what they think a federal or state court may do, number one. And because a decision was made in another state, doesn't apply at all to our state, something that the appeals federal courts or the Supreme Court would decide. And so the argument that it may, in your opinion, hold that to position, I think, is not incumbent upon this committee. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, my question is in regards to one of the parts of Representative Moe's amendment was to remove page 2, lines 12 through lines 21. And I actually, that was one of the things I liked about the bill. There was some tax advantages potentially for both sides, and I understand that the tax chair didn't like, for whatever reason, or didn't want to hear the bill, so we needed to take those provisions out. I've kind of got a parliamentary question. I believe this is being laid over for possible inclusion, and if I understand it,
actually,
that's not.
Well, it needs to go back to the Finance Committee, and then from there it could come back here at Green Book, or it can go to
Finance Committee.
It's going to the General Register.
From here, Madam Chair?
It's going to Finance, via Finance, to the General Register. So it came from Finance, it returns to Finance, and then from there to the General Register.
Well, Madam Chair, and Representative Mullen, this is a very important part of the amendment.
Maybe we can let Representative Mullen come back to the table. Thank you to the witnesses for being there. We're moving on to some other questions now. And I don't know if you weren't here, Representative McNamara, when we put on that amendment.
I was, Madam Chair, thank you. I was here for the amendment. And I was just looking it over, but I did come late for the beginning to testify. I apologize, ma'am.
So, Representative Moe, do you want to respond to that?
So, you raised some questions about the tax chair's intentions or motives, and I don't know that really is within the realm of this committee to do that. We have a fiscal note that says on the fiscal note itself, unknown. I think it would be difficult for any tax chair to include a bill in a tax bill with unknown fiscal implications. So I think that's the primary reason that we removed it from the committee. They could have heard it at a different time, and they didn't at that day. And it didn't seem to have much appeal to the opponents of the bill, and it was an effort on our part to work with them. It didn't seem to be that big a deal for them. It became very problematic for moving the legislation forward, so we withdrew that portion of the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I didn't mean to say that I know why Chair Lincheski would or would not. I didn't even know she didn't hear it. Somebody said maybe she didn't like this part of it. I got to be honest, whether she likes it or not, if this committee thinks it's the right thing to do, it's our job to put it in there. And as far as not knowing the implications, it's been very clear, conversations I've had with Representative Lincheski myself, that we do things that we don't know what the exact implications are in the tax, and I don't even want to get into all that because it's unrelated to here, but we don't necessarily know exactly what we're going to do. We don't know if it's going to get ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. We just had that discussion. I just want to know, don't you support this being in there? I think this is important for both sides, and will you support an effort to put lines 212 through 2.21 back in?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I would co-author the legislation with you next year to do just that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moore, I'm not interested in next year. I'm interested in doing it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to reinstate lines 2.12 through lines 2.21 that were removed in an earlier amendment.
Representative McNamara moves to amend House File 01 by reinserting lines 2.12.
In a roll call, Madam Chair.
Can you get that back to me? Insert lines. Did you give me the lines again?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Excuse me. It's line 2.12. Madam Chair, I wonder if the easiest part would be if we took Representative Moe's amendment, the H1301A1, and it would be delete line 1.12 of the amendment. I don't know. Maybe I'd ask counsel what's easiest for them. You want me to read the lines? Or maybe like counsel. I mess it up all the time.
This doesn't exist in the bill anymore, so we need to reinsert it. Do you want to use this as your
parliamentary inquiry?
Yeah.
If a committee passes an amendment and to get the shape, to change the shape of the bill, and then can that committee then just move to reconsider passing that amendment? I mean, or how
we could do that. We could do that, Representative Moe, if you'd like to do it that way. Representative McNamara?
Would that sort of put this, I'm still going to vote against it, Representative, but would that accomplish what you want to do here?
Well, maybe I'll defer, Madam Chair, to counsel. I'm surprised you're going to vote against it because you just told me you want to put legislation in to
do
it. I'll let counsel, Madam Chair, whatever's easiest.
Is the favor, please.
Madam Chairman, members, actually all of the A1 amendment deals with that tax advantage in three different circumstances. So if you wanted to eliminate, or you wanted to retrieve that tax advantage in all of those circumstances, you would probably want to reconsider the entire A1 amendment.
Thank you, Council. Madam Chair, I guess I would like to reconsider the previous vote for the...
So we'll have a two-part vote here, discussion on both. The first motion is to reconsider the A1 amendment. Any discussion?
I would request that we voted on this already and just continue to allow the bill to go forward without it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, ask for a roll call and reconsideration.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Shumpert.
Chairman, I just need to have something clarified. We already have the right of first refusal in law, correct? does the present law provide this tax advantage?
Madam Chair, Representative Shepard, no, it does not.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion on reconsideration of the amendment? If not, the reconsideration of A1 is before us. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Anderson? Not here. Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Eastland?
Yes.
Representative Huntley is not here. Representative Kranz?
No.
Representative Lane?
No.
Representative Medora? Is not here. Representative McFarland?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Representative Moe?
No.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Severson?
Yes.
Representative Swales?
No.
Representative Shumper?
No.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I vote no on this.
The motion fails 5-9. Okay, the bill is before us. Representative Moe, do you want to renew your motion that House file?
Oh, Representative Peterson, have a question?
Sorry, we have one more.
Well, Madam Chair, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question was going to be to the park owners, and particularly to what Representative McNamara was speaking to. You said that the park owners had no interest in engaging in this referral or deferral of capital gains tax, and I was just kind of curious to ask why they would not be interested. Is it because they just don't like the bill, because they don't want to negotiate on the bill, or is it because it was something that they financially didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal? And so I just kind of wanted to get a feed, if I could, from the park owners and their interests on that.
Okay.
And,
Mr. Bruner, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Bruner, Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. The provision regarding the tax credit is something that we would support separate from the bill as an incentive for a manufactured home park owner to sell their property to the residents, if you will, as sort of a carrot. But we simply oppose the bill and the other portions in the bill more so than we, you know, would favor the tax provisions. We would actually support the provision separately and not as a part of the bill.
Thank you. I think the bill is before us then. Representative Moe?
Just a couple quick comments. It looks like we're going to have the Severson, Moe, McNamara bill for next year for forgiveness of capital gains taxes for mobile home park owners who sell their property to tenants. Just another couple quick points. We have the right of first refusal in statute now. This is just taking away the within 1 year portion. So if this is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional now. Just to be clear, and so our contention is obviously it's not been successfully challenged in court in Minnesota. And again, we are in the state of Minnesota, just to remind everybody, we're not in California. So I appreciate the committee's support on the bill again.
Madam Chair, and I guess to that point, Madam Chair, and you know, we do law here, and you know, typically we do the law to the best interest of the people of Minnesota and the people of the United States at large. And when we're talking about referencing statute that may be in opposition to federal statute or federal constitution, I think we need to weigh into this a little trepidation to say, you know, we're just going to continue to push the envelope here, where they've already challenged the federal statutes on the 5th and the 14th Amendment in California and lost. Why would we go after something that has already been litigated at the federal, at the state level on a federal constitutional issue, and throw taxpayers' money at an issue that's already been addressed in another state? So I guess when we're talking about making legislation at the state level, we always need to be cognizant of constitutional issues, that we're operating within the confines of the Constitution. If we're going to push the envelope on this particular issue, then people of Minnesota need to understand that we're doing this willingly to use some of their tax dollars to push forward a policy that has been proven in another state to be in violation of the Constitution. And I would, for that reason, I would urge a no vote. Let's be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars in this particular situation, and vote this provision down. And I would ask for a roll call, Madam Chair.
Roll call has been requested, and Vice Chair is taking over.
Uh-oh.
You sure with that, Adam?
Stand by.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Okay, so I believe we are, the roll call of Representative Peterson is to the bill.
That's correct.
Moving out of here. And most correct, I think, just so we're all clear on this. Representative Moe, you are looking to get this bill out of here and send it to the General Register.
Yeah. So it has to go to
finance and then on the way. So we're going to a yes vote is to get this out of here, a no vote is to. So,
all right. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Anderson is not here. Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Eastland?
No.
Representative Huntley is not here. Representative Kranz?
Yes.
Representative Lane?
Yes.
Representative Medora?
Yes.
Representative McClellan?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Moe?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Severson?
No.
Representative Swales?
Yes.
Representative Shumper?
Yes.
Motion carries, 10 to 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Next up, we have House File 1621, Representative Bunn.
I think I saw her.
Okay, in front of us, members, we have the House File 1621. The chair will make the motion. Representative Bunn, would you like this to go?
Mr. Chair, Ag Finance has requested to see this bill too, so we were asking that you move it to Ag Finance.
Okay.
Maybe that requires going through finance again.
Yeah. Okay. The chair's motion on this bill is to pass it out of this committee and send it to back to finance, or to finance.
Yeah.
I think, representatives, you have another amendment coming around that I hope. Okay, a substitute amendment that maybe the author will give us some ideas about what this is,
yeah,
and then I will move it forward.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it's not a substitute amendment. It is a line-by-line amendment. If you've all read the bill and done your homework, this would be useful to you, but maybe I should have gone for a delete all since there's quite a few things here, but let me talk about them. I ask for your patience with this because we have been very involved with stakeholders in the last week and a half. This bill has already been through three committees. This will be the fourth, I believe, now. And so we have gotten lots of inputs both from legislators and from stakeholders in the last week and a half. So we have strived very diligently in the last day or two to make a number of changes that clean up portions of language, make it much tighter and a much better bill. And we think we've arrived at a better bill.
Okay, so, Representative Bonham, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. I know that staff is handing out the A4 amendment. So I believe that we have an A3 amendment, and you're asking us to disregard that.
I have no idea what the A3 amendment is, so maybe that should be explained to me.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So I know, representatives, in your packets, you had an A3 amendment. Just put that in the discard pile. We're working on, and I believe the amendment we have in question here is the A4 amendment.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, you actually have a few oral amendments to the A4 amendment.
Okay, let's make the movement here on just the A4 amendment, and this is what you'd like to have in the bill.
Correct, but don't we amend it first, then?
Yes, we're going to move this first. I'm just double-checking.
No, and then I thought we did the... Okay.
We're going to move it first. Are there any questions to the A4 amendment to just get this thing in the shape of the Constitution?
Mr. Chair, I guess what I was asking, I think we make the oral amendments to the A4 amendment first, and then we move the entire thing, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think we can probably do it either way.
Okay.
Which way? Staff, help me out.
Okay.
Okay.
with the amendment. Well, let's amend the amendment first, and then we'll get it all on there. Okay. So, okay, let's Representative Bond, move on just your amendments to the amendment,
okay.
And we'll take up action on
okay.
that. Does that make sense, members?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we have, I believe, four oral amendments to the bill. First of all, in line 1.5, after the word commissioner, insert the words in cooperation with the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
How about that? Can I?
Around the building.
Around the amendment.
Around the amendment.
Around the amendment.
And I think you, the Commission of Health in cooperation.
Oh, excuse me,
that's
the word health.
Thank
my apologies.
You. Why don't you give us that oral amendment again?
In line 1.5, after the word health, in cooperation with the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
Okay.
Then on line 3.9, after the second comma, 3.9, there's just a tight white O here, two extra words that were just in by mistake. On 3.9, after the second comma, so that's after the word requested comma, just delete the words and shall. And delete the words and shall.
Okay.
Then, further to the bottom of that page, I will ask Emily Cleveland's staff to indicate the next oral amendment.
Page 3, line 27, after the semicolon, insert and. Page 3, line 28, delete semicolon and, insert a period. And page 3, line 29, delete the parenthetical 3, and insert the commissioner shall also appoint.
And finally, there's one last one in the appropriations section on the last page. Page 4 in section 6, again, I'll ask staff and Ms. Cleveland to explain the oral amendment.
So page 4, line 25, delete $450,000 and insert blank. Same line, delete $700,000 and insert blank. Page 4, line 28, delete $450,000 and insert blank. Same line, delete $700,000 and insert blank. And then line, page 4, line 29, delete state government special revenue and insert environmental.
One last, in addition to that, the word environmental should be capitalized. And the word fund that follows that should also be capitalized. Okay. Again, I thank you for your patience. Discussions about how to fund this continue till about 5 minutes before this committee. So.
Are there any questions from members to the oral amendment? Okay, now to the amendment itself. Representative McNair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have kind of a procedural question. Representative Bunn, we heard this bill last night in Environment Finance, and I'm trying to understand what happened there. It was an informational hearing. Was the bill not formally before our committee last night?
Right, that's why it was an informational hearing.
So
it had not been sent to your committee, but your chair requested to hear it informally so it would be heard by your committee.
Representative
McNamara. So are we sending it back there for the Environment Committee to vote on this? Was it not there because it hadn't cleared the House through the floor? Is that why it was not able to be heard as a bill? I'm trying to figure out. So the House Environment Finance Committee is not going to vote on this bill?
That is my understanding currently.
Mr. Chair. So this is recommended to pass and go to the floor, Representative Bunn?
No, it's going... Sorry, Mr. Chair. No, it's going back to finance, and then it's going to ag finance, and the path from there is not yet clear. Yes.
Representative Bunn, I'm a co-author on this bill. This is an important bill, but I also believe it needs to be in environment finance for a vote, and I gotta admit, last night I thought it was before us for an informational hearing because it was not in order and hadn't been processed. I didn't realize the thoughts. So is it your intention to bring it back to Chair Wagenius's committee?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative McNamara, if that's what they would like, that would be fine. We have not had a request for that.
Representative McNamara. So I just want to be clear. I just believe Representative Wagenius is going to want to hear this. This is an important bill. If she wants to hear it, it's your intention to bring it back there.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, absolutely. Okay. She has been part of the discussions for the entire last 2 weeks, and in fact, she has been part of the discussion today to change the language in the appropriation section.
All right. Mm-hmm. So any other questions or comments to the amendment as amended?
Fiscal law.
I'm just looking for any other questions before we start moving on to this.
I wonder, could the author kind of explain the amendment, what it does, and then maybe on the appropriations section, how that works, if there's blank appropriations there, and so on.
Representative Bond.
Yeah, although what you're voting on now is just the changes, the amendments to the amendment, not the amendment itself.
Speak to either.
Okay, so either.
I thought you said the amendment.
No, he said the amendments. You know.
Okay.
Well, I'll speak to both at one time. In terms of the appropriation section, the blanks, I can give you a full explanation. The fiscal note, I do know the fiscal note. I don't know if you've received the fiscal note. The fiscal note that was done early on the Senate side when it appeared. The fiscal note is about $900,000 for the first year. I recall $1.2 million or so for the second year. The only reason for the blanks is for them to sort out between the various sources of funding what there hasn't been any agreement about how it would be allocated between the sources. And so didn't want to specify at this time, and that be worked out with the chairs involved in the committees that would be financing eventually. But we do have information on the general dollar amount that we're looking for in both years. In terms of the amendment itself, relative to the bill that you have in your hand, there's a couple different features to what's being done here. One is just clearing up some technical language, so some technical changes. There's a number of technical changes spread throughout the amendment that have to do with making sure the language in the bill corresponds to our data practices law. We're not changing or amending data practices law, we're just making sure that the language in the bill is in correspondence to our current data practices law. Also changes to make clear in the bill issues about informed consent, confidentiality, those kinds of things, what protocols are being followed, what institutional rewards are being used, those kinds of things. So this bill has been through three committees. People were seeking further clarity in the bill on those issues, so we just cleared all that out to make it very solid. Another issue is in terms of the word hazardous that appears in front of the word chemicals many times throughout the bill. Which chemicals are going to be designated for the biomonitoring program is spelled out in detail in terms of what scientific criteria will be used to select them. So we didn't think the word hazardous needed to appear throughout the bill. What chemicals are being used and what criteria is spelled out in the section of the bill. The word exposed groups, the term exposed groups, has been deleted from the bill. And in place of it, we have incorporated the word community, which is defined in the amendment on page 1.25. So everywhere the word exposed group appears in the bill or groups, we are now using the word community or communities. And that definition, which is a much fuller, clearer definition than we originally had, is included on line 1.25. So again, to just make it tighter, clearer to all those involved. Another issue in terms of improving in the bill is that the advisory panel, which we'll describe in a minute, on the bill
is an advisory panel for both the health tracking and biomonitoring program. It included general counsel of science is appointed by the commissioner. It also included in the original language four people from NGOs and then also representatives from the agencies. We have now specified that everyone involved except those from the agencies that we hope they might be well are some type of science person who has the expertise, the appropriate scientific background to be part of this panel, whether they're from NGO and university or appointed generally by the commissioner, that this is really a science-based panel to oversee these programs and that they have the appropriate professional background. So those are the main things that we're doing with this amendment. That's the key features that we've addressed with this amendment.
Okay. No other questions or notes at this time. The chair moves the oral amendments to the amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That's done. And then the chair also will move the A4 amendment to the bill 1621 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That carries. Good. Now, Representative Bunn, you have amended amendment to your bill. To the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your patience and members. Very pleased to be here. Last week in another committee, I heard a county commissioner testify on behalf of the child welfare bill that the role of government was to do roads, safe neighborhoods, and basic public health protections. I think most people agree we think the role of the government is a little bit broader than those three things, but I want to emphasize that this person included basic public health protections among the top three things that they viewed as government performing for its citizens. This bill before you today is about that provision of basic public health protections. This bill would establish two different programs that are interrelated but distinct. It establishes an environmental health tracking program and a biomonitoring program for Minnesota. Environmental pollutants have been shown to cause or worsen a number of chronic diseases or disease conditions. Communities and health professionals need solid, reliable information about the relationship between pollutants and disease. Minnesota needs to establish a system to assess relationships between environmental hazards and disease, provide useful information to the public and to policymakers, and to develop strategies to prevent environmental-related illnesses. By passing this legislation, Minnesota can take steps to protect the health of its people and begin catching up with dozens of other states that have adopted and established health tracking systems as part of a health tracking network nationally. This type of public effort would be useful for communities around the state who have experienced exposure to hazardous chemicals. As you all know, while this is separate from this bill coming forward, this bill pre-existed this most recent issue, but I come from a district from the East Metro that has been experiencing this problem with PFEA solutions more recently. And these kind of situations create a sense of uncertainty among the residents that needs to be addressed somehow. There are many different actions being taken to address their concerns. A program like this would just be one component of addressing these kind of concerns in the longer run if it was available. When people experiencing exposures to chemicals, they're concerned about health risks and about body burdens of those chemicals. Gathering health and exposure information in these scenarios can help develop risk prevention efforts to protect the public health. Real data does not create health scares. Rather, it would dispel baseless health scares and allow us to address actual threats to health, not perceived threats to health. We can no longer afford to avoid this type of analysis, and as my testifiers will speak about shortly, it can actually be a tremendous benefit to us to help save some money in the system overall. I want to point out a couple things. One is many different organizations have already put their support behind this initiative. Among them are the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota, the League of Minnesota Voters, Land Stewardship Project, the Isaac Walton League, and others. So there is some general public support for this bill. Just briefly to go over the bill as it in terms of what it does, I'll let my testifiers primarily focus, but I mentioned it has the two programs, health tracking, and I'll let them describe that, biomonitoring, and it has a pilot program for biomonitoring. There are many different approaches to tackling the biomonitoring issue.
all of them require that you have some baseline data of some kind. And that can be baseline data in terms of the level of biochemicals in human specimens. And that baseline data can be established internationally, through international bodies, through our own CDC, NIH, other kinds of organizations, or it could be actually pursued by our own state through its program. What is proposed in this bill is some pilot programs that is not going after trying to establish a statewide scientific sampling of the population, which is being pursued in at least one of the states, like California in this instance. What this bill is doing is having a few pilot programs to kind of test our capability in the state to go in this direction by doing these pilots. But in every instance, we would choose chemicals to use in these pilots only if we have this baseline data elsewhere to compare the results to or to use in conjunction with it. So they are scientifically valid, the pilot programs, because we'll all be looking at, we have a reference with baseline data elsewhere, or we have reference scientifically information based on animal studies that have been peer-reviewed, or some other kind of base data, reference data to use in relation to these pilot programs. So that's the intent. Finally, as I mentioned, we have a health tracking biomonitoring advisory panel that will have, I believe it's now 11 people on it. Eight of those will be science people with science, extensive science backgrounds that are relevant to these issues, and the other three will be three commissioners from the agencies. So with that, I'm going to turn over to my testifiers and we'll let them introduce themselves. Also, there are a number of people from the Department of Health here who might want to chime in response to your questions or comment if you'd like them to. And I think there are also other people here that might like to testify for or against this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bunn. I'm actually going to ask our audience here, is there anybody who would like to speak against this bill? Anybody that would like to speak in favor of this bill? Wonderful. To your supporters here at the table, you have 10 minutes. Let's keep this moving. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Samuel Yaman, public health scientist with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and in light of the time constraints, I will keep my remarks really brief, but if there's anything that I skip over, I'd be glad to answer questions that go to those details.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This legislation is designed to help reduce the burden of chronic disease on families and the healthcare system. Chronic diseases impose a huge cost on society in terms of both health and economics. Scientific studies have identified specific chemicals and metals as risk factors for chronic diseases, including cancer, asthma, adverse reproductive outcomes such as infertility and spontaneous abortion, nervous system diseases such as Parkinson's, childhood developmental and behavioral disorders, and others. We know that pollutants found in air, water, and soil can cause disease, but we lack data on the proportion of chronic diseases attributable to environmental pollutants, whether it's 1%, 5%, 20%, or some other percentage. This makes it exceedingly difficult to protect the public from these preventable illnesses. Environmental health tracking is the best way to close this data gap and provide health professionals and the public with solid, reliable information. Gathering information on health hazards is fundamental to public health practice. Without this knowledge, regulatory programs and disease prevention efforts are fraught with uncertainty. I would just mention briefly that around the country, over 20 states have successfully implemented environmental health tracking systems. Wisconsin is a great example of how this work is carried out on the state level. They've modernized their systems for looking at cancer and pollutants, which has allowed them to focus their resources on real cancer risks and not worry about sources of pollutants that are not a real risk. They have also used the tracking to develop interventions to save lives from carbon monoxide poisonings. Finally, Wisconsin has also used extensive biomonitoring to test levels of mercury among voluntary participants who eat a lot of fish or may otherwise be exposed to mercury, and this has helped that state optimize the fish consumption advisories to reflect real data on mercury hazards. And finally, this area of public health
public health practice is very cost-effective. A 2001 economic analysis was published that estimated that the federal government would recoup $1.44 for every $1 invested in environmental health tracking. Similar returns are expected for state and local governments who invest in this. Additional savings would accrue to families and healthcare systems who currently are paying the high costs of chronic diseases. At this point, I would, due to time constraints, I'd like to conclude my testimony because we all have the privilege of hearing from Dr. Bill Toscano from the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Gavin.
Thank you. I'm Bill Toscano. I'm head of Environmental Health Sciences at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to come here. I will be very brief. This bill is very important to the state, to the citizens of the state, and to our ability to assess risk in humans. We live in a chemical sea, as everybody knows. Everybody's worried about things that we don't know anything about. We have animal studies that suggest some things, but we have very little data to show what is it in humans. And so this bill will allow us to have a better handle on exact exposures to the humans and the connection to environmentally caused diseases. And we have a State Health Department laboratory which is outstanding in its ability to do these kinds of assays, so I think the startup time to get it going will be relatively fast. In 2000, our national body ranked all the states with their ability to measure environmental toxicants and to follow the diseases in humans that are caused by them, and we got an F. We were right there with Mississippi. Texas had an A, and that's because they were ahead of us. And then the health department applied for a planning opportunity with CDC, and they got that grant. That moved us up to a C, which is still just average, not good enough. And I think the state of Minnesota is usually thought of as a leader in environmental health. We're usually ranked with California and Massachusetts in this regard, and this will give us an opportunity to be up there with them. One last thing is that this issue is an important national issue, too. This was a report that was published by the National Academy of Sciences on the application of human biomonitoring for environmental chemicals. And there's a big push in the federal government as well to sort of start getting these data, collecting these data in the states. So I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
Any questions from the committee members for the author or the witnesses? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions. One is, I think you kind of touched on the data privacy stuff and all, and I appreciate the fact that that's in there. But I'm just noticing that going through the language, I was reading through it, and there's an emphasis on voluntary participation, and on page 4 it talks about 300 voluntary participants. And then when you get down to subdivision 3, it talks about participation. It once again says that they're voluntary. And then it goes on to say minors may participate in the program if a written consent is signed by the minor's parent or legal guardian. But there's nothing in here that says that a voluntary participant has to sign off. And so there's a record of the fact that they... I guess I'm assuming that that's probably how it would work, but I guess would you be open to putting a little language in there to kind of give me a comfort on that? So like I'm just looking at line 4.6, if we could make that line read, or 4.26, pardon me, after voluntary, just add the little phrase, and requires written consent.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Mr. Eastland,
maybe something else is in here that I haven't seen.
Well, elsewhere in the bill, there's an entire section referring to both, well, there's portions that refer both to the use of NIH protocols for informed consent, and also a portion referring to the Institutional Review Board, which is part of the Department of Health process. And my understanding from previous testimony, but they can come up and tell you themselves if they'd like, the Department of Health, is that there is an extensive signing of documents to give informed consent in all these processes for every volunteer that would be involved.
Okay, I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm fine with that. I'm not familiar with all of the other things that are involved. It just seems like in the bill, it would be nice to know that that's what informed consent means. Really they have signed off and said that they. Would you be open to that amendment, that just small amendment, to just add that language and requires written consent?
Representative Bunn. I believe we can do that, but the written consent is in the other sections in terms of what's implied with non-implied, but it's a subset of that stuff. Could I just briefly have someone from the Department of Health just address this particular issue of the consent that's involved?
Sure.
Okay. Very quickly. I know it's an important issue that we all assured on this point.
Welcome to the committee. Your name.
Thank you very much. My name is Louise Liao. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, Public Health Laboratories. And thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Hold on. Representative Eason, can you just kind of refresh the witness here now with what you're looking at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just looking for some comfort language in the bill that would really state real clearly that participation requires a written consent.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Eason. Yes, in fact, with regards to lines... Okay, it's already in page 5, line 13, says the informed consent. Page 5, line 13, the informed consent used for the program must meet the informed consent protocols developed by the National Institutes of Health. And as been spoken to just a moment ago, the protocols developed by the National Institutes of Health for informed consent require the signatures. Certainly I understand the question about having it explicit in the bill also. It would be in one sense redundant, in another sense it would make it more lucid.
I mean, I guess I would just offer that as an amendment that would not be out of line with the author at this point.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to accept that as a friendly amendment to the bill.
Let's work on now the exact language we're talking about, just for the record.
It's line 4.26 is where, after voluntary, just the phrase, and what I jotted down was, and requires written consent. And that written consent then would be clarified with the language that she talked about. That's the written consent that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. All the members have that. Representative Shumpert.
Sorry, I just had another question.
Mr. Chair, staff from the Department of Health has indicated to me that based on traditional practice, it requires written informed consent. If we could have the word informed in there.
That's fine.
Makes it stronger.
Yep. I'm fine.
Good.
Stronger, better.
Okay, so to the amendment, everybody, members, have any questions to the amendment? Everybody stands. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Then, Mr. Chair, I have one more question.
Representative Eason.
On the bill, on page 2, and this is just maybe a question as to where the bill has been and what it's kind of. I guess it's on page 2, but it's more clearly on page 5, on page 6, I guess. Subdivision 1 on the top page 6 talks about the creation of a board or of a panel of the Environmental Health Tracking Environmental Advisory Panel, I think it's the rules of our body here that if a commissioner or a board is created, that it needs to go. This needs to go to GovOps, and I wonder if that has been the route, or if that's planned to be part of the route.
Representative
Bud, this issue was raised very early on, and I with the chair of GovOps, and for a reason I think having to do with it, because it was a scientific panel that was being convened. He said it didn't need to come to his committee.
Okay.
Because of the, I mean, there is a distinction between different types of panels, evidently, and maybe he had another reason at that time, but that's what was conveyed to me through the staff.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair.
I did ask him if he'd like to see it.
I'm looking at her and talking to you, Mr. Chair. If that may have been conveyed through staff, but I mean, what Representative Pawlowski said on the floor yesterday was pretty clear that he was not particularly happy that some of the bills that had this stuff in it were not coming to this committee. And I guess typically it's the chair that makes that decision. So I guess that would be my question.
Mr. Chair, let me clarify. It came from him to, I mean, to me, actually. We did run it by him in the early stages. So I can go back to him and see if he would like to.
I guess I would like it. I would like that to at least be considered and verified, because this clearly, from the rules that we operate from, should at least pass through that committee. I mean, it wouldn't have to be more than a 5-minute hearing if you just want to hear it. But
there this morning with another.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. The recommendation and request is noted. Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Dr. Toscano. Our state has a has a pesticide monitoring program that some people feel is quite adequate or extensive. Other people maybe disagree. I'm wondering, isn't that in itself sufficient for environmental health tracking?
No.
And if not, why not? Could you explain that?
I would be happy to. We have a lot of information about ambient exposures. We know a lot about what's in the environment, what's in the water we're drinking, but we have no real feeling for the amount that is actually taken in and distributed within the body. And so our risk assessments that we're doing now are sort of carried out not based on biology, but based on wishful thinking, hopefulness. Our hands are really tied for actually having a scientifically based, biologically based risk assessment. So that is not really satisfactory in the sense of having the exact track of the exposure, the amount, and disease or not disease. So.
Okay. Representative Shumpert.
Just to follow up, we do a lot of research on frogs and rodents and so on. Can't you extrapolate from that to the human experience or not?
We do that all the time. However, Representative. We do that all the time. But the problem it becomes that people are uneasy about those extrapolations. And so therefore they get dismissed by some groups. And those same data can be used by activists to make one point and by other groups to make another point. And the point is we just don't know because they're in animals, not humans. And the physiology is a little different, not the same, but not always greatly different, but they are different.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn. I'm just wondering, the appropriation for the Department of Health, is that to come out of this committee's budget then?
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair and Representative McFarland, yes, it would.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Any discussion on this bill? Once again, the chair will renew his motion to move it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions for the Department of Health. On the fiscal note, it mentions that there's about 8.5 FTEs anticipated to be hired, and then it mentions 6 different classes of employees listed in the plural, or at least the first 4 are listed in the plural, and I'm just wondering. Representative Eastland and I were just talking about a lot of the good information that would be found with this bill. And I'm just curious, will you be able to do all this with 8.5 and 10.5 FTEs? I'm sorry, 8.5 in the first year, and it looks like 12.5 after that. And then it looks like the tails are that it would be an ongoing program. And I guess that would be a question for Representative Bunn, that I'm assuming it is designed to be an ongoing program with tails.
Senator McNamara and members of the committee. The fiscal note, I can speak pretty intelligently with regards to the biomonitoring portion. I would ask someone else to come up to the front of the room to speak with regards to the environmental health tracking portion. With regards to the biomonitoring portion, the way we constructed the fiscal note was to indeed address what is in the bill with regards to the pilot program. You understand, as you said, the bill has the pilot and then it has the base moving beyond that. And we tried to be conservative
and we try to adhere to the intent and what is written in the bill. And so with regards to the biomonitoring portion, we had, for example, validation of some of the protocols in year one, and then implement particular community studies, particular chemicals in year two while we're validating another set, and studying that community in year three, validating another set, and studying that community in year four. So I do believe that the pilot programs in the 4 years will progress from each of the four sets of chemicals that are listed in the bill. You have another question? That wasn't enough.
Well, just thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the test fire. So you're comfortable that the number of FTEs are accurate, the 8.5 and 12.5 in the second year and ongoing in total?
Ms. Lau. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, and members of the committee, yes, I am.
Thank you.
Okay. Once again, the chair will renew his motion again to pass, and we refer this to finance, I believe, is where we're going with this. Now, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay. Motion carries, and you're on your way, Representative Bunn. Next up, we have House File 1997, Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to give you a good dose of atrazine this week. Pardon the pun. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move approval of House File 1997 with a free referral to Ag Finance.
Wonderful.
Simple and easy.
To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to make a verbal amendment on the second page lines. I want to add line 230, a section 2, an effective date. Line 231, section 1 is effective the day following final enactment. We just need an effective date.
Representative Shumpert, you need to cut one more time.
On page 2 of 1997.
Yep.
Just adding an effective date would be line. It would be a new line, line 2.3, which would say section 2 effective date.
2.30.
Yes, I'm sorry. 2.30, and then line 2.31 would say section 1 is effective the day following final enactment.
Okay. Staff have that. In fact, just to confirm that, I'm going to have staff, read back that amendment.
I think you could just do it as page 2 after line 29, insert effective date. This section is effective the day following final
order. Any questions or discussions to the amendment? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we're ready to go with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just briefly cover the bill. House File 1997, I think, has three main points. First of all, it does not ban atrazine. I know some people think it does or will, but it doesn't. It actually builds on House File 1986, which we heard on Wednesday. What it does is it puts into motion more scientific review and scrutiny in relationship to the chemicals, the pesticides described in House File 1997. Endocrine disrupting pesticides, known carcinogenic pesticides, and high potency nervous system toxins. Second, and thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, it shifts the main role of registering pesticides from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to the Minnesota Department of Health. And again, this builds on a lot of information. I'm sure we'd all love to hear Professor Hayes' presentation again today, but just imagine that you've just heard it, because much of what he discussed in his presentation on Wednesday certainly applies to House File 1997. This bill puts primary emphasis on health. It will focus on current research that's occurring in the field today, and it will certainly focus on atrazine, which is demonstrably an endocrine disruptor. I think that was pretty well demonstrated on Wednesday. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture will still play a key role in the pesticide registration, and correctly so. It has extensive network of expertise at collecting and disseminating pesticide information. It has a monitoring program. I think there's some debate about how extensive or adequate the monitoring program is. But MDA also does applicator training, and it's in charge of a best management practices program. And so they're intimately involved in the pesticide registration program. But what MDA does not do is it does not develop the standards, and I believe it lacks the expertise to do health risk assessments. And so that's the primary focus of this bill, is to move the health risk aspects of pesticide registration to the Department of Health. And of course, as we know from sitting on this committee, that the Department of Health has a huge amount of expertise in this area to do health risk assessments. I should point out that in 1989, Minnesota passed its Minnesota Groundwater Act, which was perceived as groundbreaking activity at that time. It was almost 20 years ago now. And at that time, one of the primary reasons was for the detection of atrazine that was occurring at that time. And so here we are, almost 20 years later, I think, still dealing with that issue. And, you know, if you look at this whole process of pesticide registration enough and think about it enough, it seems to me, and again, I don't want to make any point of criticism, but it seems to me that vesting all of this decision-making about pesticides in the Department of Agriculture creates an inherent conflict of interest. The Department of Agriculture has as its primary role to promote agriculture in our state, and it does an excellent job of that, in my opinion, in many respects. And of course, pesticide regulation is part of that, but then it seems to me that inherently conflicts when you start to consider the health implications of whether or not certain pesticides should be regulated. And so from that standpoint also, it makes sense to move the primary lead role in pesticide regulations out of the Department of Agriculture into the Department of Health, just for that inherent conflict of interest problem. I think you have a number of handouts. I'd like to review some of them briefly with you. One is from the Office of Legislative Auditor. I do have the entire report, which I didn't copy for you. This came out just last year, just a year ago this March, and it was to evaluate pesticide regulation in Minnesota. And it's really well worth reading. And in general, it gave the Department of Agriculture high marks for most things, but some of the problem areas were in part two, and I think you have a 3 or 4 page handout there where I've highlighted various things. The primary, and you can kind of review that for yourself, but primarily it was the opinion of the Department of Legislative Auditor that the department seldom uses the authority it has to document or pursue more information that would elicit more scientific information about the health risks of the pesticides that it's registering. And, you know, obviously from what Dr. Toscano just mentioned, we don't know very much yet about the impact of pesticides on human health in this state. And so the main emphasis, in my opinion, here is to try to shift that burden to the Department of Health. I also have a letter here as a handout from Dr. Alexander over in the University of Minnesota on it, and I would refer you to the second page of that, or on the back side, I guess, on your copy. He also points out if you scroll through that paragraph quickly, says one issue that has become clear to me through the study that they did on a different pesticide, but this is a general comment, is that the lack of good exposure information about most segments of the population. I think think that's clearly the case, as we heard documented by Dr. Hayes on Wednesday, and as we hear even in a previous bill discussed before you. So we have this huge problem of not knowing how much exposure the population, the human population in Minnesota has. We have the problem of the agency that's promoting and helping farming be successful, also in charge of the registration of the pesticides. And so the thrust of my bill is to move the primary player, the primary emphasis on that, or activity for that, into the Department of Health. I think you also had a handout on the back, some background information of Syngenta. Syngenta is the producer of atrazine. They're headquartered in Switzerland, and we have seen this information the other day. So with that as background, I also want to add a couple other things. This bill is a work in progress. You know, there's a lot of discussions I'm having, have had in the last few days with both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health people in those departments, and hope to have in the future on developing this bill. And again, designing a bill that I think will work better in this state in terms of adequately protecting the public's interest in regards to pesticides and specifically with atrazine. And, you know, that's why I'm very agreeable to having it going to Representative Junkie's Ag Finance Committee. I think there's important discussions we have to have there with the agricultural community. I think most of you know I am a farmer. I'm not naive about the implications of this type of legislation to agriculture. I'm certainly quite, you know, I'm not naive about how a good segment of the agricultural community feels about this particular chemical. It's used extensively in Minnesota, but I am determined to pursue this. I am determined to pursue protecting the public's interest and the public health here, and that's why I'm authoring this bill and bringing it forward. I do have a couple of witnesses I'd like to have testify.
Before we do that, is anybody in the audience that'd like to speak against this bill? Okay, we have equal time for both times, so let's try to stick 10 minutes, no more.
Sure, that's fine.
Give the opposition the same amount of time.
I'll be much less.
Appreciate that.
I'm Vinny Terry. I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota Medical School, director of environmental medicine. I'm a board certified toxicologist, a member of the board of directors of the American Board of Toxicology, so I know a little bit about this. And if this disruption was kind of brought up by Theo Colburn years ago, and the question actually gets down to this point. We operate on the basis of our hormones a lot. Hormones are present in our bloodstream at very low concentrations and have very big effects. They will control, for example, the thyroid hormone would control our metabolism. It makes us fat, it makes us thin, it makes us jumpy, it makes us thinking, it makes us not thinking. So there are a number of issues surrounding how hormones act. And then there's the other part is that every hormone hits what we call a little receptor, and it pings it off and makes a whole bunch of things cascade and happen. What happens when you have endocrine disruption, you have a little interference in that signaling pathway. And that throws off everything. Now, in studies that we've published out of Minnesota here, we looked at things like thyroid hormone and pesticide applicators. We looked at reproductive hormones and pesticide applicators. We've actually looked at sperm and a whole bunch of other things. And we published on all of this. And for example, in the pesticide applicators in the Reservoir Valley, you can see that they have a cyclic variation in their thyroid hormone status based on their exposure to certain kind of fungicides. You can also see that if you have lower levels of testosterone in some of the individuals, you'll see where they'll have more girl babies than boy babies. It shifts the sex ratio. So a lot of little tweaking of hormones can do a lot. And the other thing is that now we're using all different kinds of pesticides and mixtures, and because of that, we run a risk of what we call an additive or a synergistic effect of all of these chemicals together. And we haven't got the foggiest of what's going on. not the fog is, and it's very difficult to make these analyses. Also very expensive. Those studies that I talked to you about, we had several million dollars worth of federal dollars to do them. So when you get into this thing, you are then going to be committed in the long term, and you should be interested in kind of accepting that fact. And the monies that you're getting for this kind of thing should be realized as baseline dollars, and that folks are going to have to build upon through federal funding as well. That's about all I have to say.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Paul, is that a
Shumpert? Okay, sure.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm here to testify today on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. The Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that works to promote sustainable agriculture.
I'm going to ask you also to state your name.
Okay, it's Paul Sobosinski.
Sobosinski, thank you.
And the Land Stewardship Project works on behalf of supporting sustainable agriculture. We mean supporting the farmer, the environment, and the community with a special ethic towards stewardship. This bill calls for more scientific review and scrutiny, on the chemicals that family farmers are using in their state. The testimony of Tyrone Hayes the other day for me was eye-opening and struck close to home. I have used atrazine on my farm in the last many number of years. And it caused me at least to evaluate about whether that's something I should continue to do. Family farmers are on the front lines as it relates also to health, because very often farmers are the applicants. In my case, I have a local dealer who applies the product. But our fields are close to our homes, it's close to our streams, it's close to our livestock. So it's a reason for us to be concerned, and we are concerned, I think, as a whole. Having a more secure, check and balance system, having the Department of Health playing that role, I think is an important piece to do. As I said, family farms do care. In terms of looking at this bill overall, I think it's a step in the right direction. But I think it's also a discussion that needs to happen, in our ag community, in our total community, in terms of the environment, in terms of health. When I look at this piece, looking at the total big picture, as we start to talk about some of the chemicals or altering what we might be doing in terms of chemicals on the land, and one piece is for farmers to just stop using chemicals. Matter of fact, Representative Jumper has a bill that calls for $1.1 million to be sent to the University of Minnesota for an organic initiative to help farmers make that transition. But even if that bill becomes law, for example, the ability of all the farmers to change just like that isn't there. A second aspect that I think ought to be looked at is an assessment of the chemicals that farmers use, so they have a sort of a sense about what's better and what isn't better in terms as it affects public health, including their health. I think a third piece is looking at in terms as farmers are using chemicals, and that's one piece I don't think can just change overnight, but as farmers are using chemicals, how we're protecting our soil and our water. For example, for the last couple of years, we've been working to get Clean Water Legacy funded. And Clean Water Legacy has a stakeholder groups that includes all the farm group, a number of key farm groups in the state, and people from the environmental community. Adequate funding of that is a very important piece as looking at how we protect our soil and our water. Another initiative that's being talked at the University of Minnesota that former Senator Steve Morris has been very involved in is called the Landscape for Human Health. It's green land, blue waters. We need to look at a total picture as we're moving forward, and I support the concept of this bill moving forward, and I support the concept of us having a bigger discussion in agriculture about what that means. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Zobosinski. Anybody else that you have, Mr. Shumpert? Representative Shumpert, excuse me.
Yes, I had Mr. Stoddard from the department.
Okay, we got about 3 minutes left.
Okay, that's fine. I'm wondering about that. Mr. Stoddard is a hydrologist, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the hydrologic cycle.
as it impacts Atherton.
Good.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director for Environmental Programs at the Minnesota Department of Ag. I actually came prepared to talk about monitoring results for atrazine, but 3 minutes isn't enough. So what I will say is that we do find atrazine commonly in groundwater in Minnesota. We find it commonly in areas where groundwater is vulnerable at low levels. Where we have sampled wells, we do not find concentrations greater than one part per billion. The health standard right now is above that, so we really don't find exceedances of the health standard. We do extensive monitoring in the central sand plains for trends, which is very expensive monitoring. We've got dedicated wells, 82 steps of wells. And we have found that over the last 10 to 15 years, the concentration is decreasing significantly. We think that's appropriate given the change in practices over this time. We also find atrazine very commonly in surface waters, and where we find it, and the concentrations really varies dramatically depending upon the year. What happens is someone will apply it to the land, and how the amount of concentration that we find in surface water is directly related to how soon after they apply it we get a rainstorm. You get a rainstorm, you get a flushing effect, and you tend to find high concentrations in that first peak coming off. So the way we sample, we actually do automated sampling where we change the concentration or monitor the concentration over time, and we can see that when you get that first flush, you tend to get a high concentration, and it drops off, and it does change over time. Although I want to emphasize there's extreme variability in surface water, so that changes from year to year, from water body to water body. The other thing you should know for surface waters is it's not unusual to find a high concentration, perhaps as high as 30 parts per billion, which is very high, but that may not exceed a health standard. Even though the health standard may be lower, or the surface water standard may be lower, in order to exceed that standard, you have to have a duration of exposure. So it has to be 30 parts per billion for 4 days. I think the health standard is 3.4 parts per billion in a drinking water body for 30 days, or 10 parts per billion for 4 days. So you might get a quick flush that could be very high, but it may still not exceed the standard over time. The last thing I wanted to comment on is we also find atrazine in precipitation, and sometimes we find it at fairly high concentrations. Again, it varies year to year. It wouldn't be, some years the average has been as high as 6/10 of a part per billion. We've seen concentrations as high as 2 parts per billion from rainwater. And what happens is as they apply atrazine farther south in the U.S., as it warms up, it can volatilize or it can come up with dust, and then it travels through the air, and then it can settle out in precipitation. So atrazine is fairly common in waters of the state, especially in vulnerable waters. We do find it in precipitation and surface waters, but the concentrations tend to be low. And they tend to not exceed standards. Although in southeast Minnesota, the concentrations in one water body and possibly two are high enough, so they are approaching and may actually be exceeding standards. So I just want to give you a quick update.
Thank you, Mr. Stoddard. I think in the last two committee hearings, we're becoming experts in not only chemistry, but also anatomy here. That's just through the entire testimony. We got exactly 10 minutes, so let's give the opposition the same amount of time. Those who would like to speak in opposition to this bill, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair. I'm Kim Sheeney, Policy Director with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I will just be very brief. I just am here to state the administration's position in opposition to this bill. We believe that it blurs the lines of responsibilities between the state agencies and creates legal confusion between state and federal law. It duplicates what the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is already doing, and we believe it would be very costly to the state to do this duplication. We do recognize that some pesticides are dangerous chemicals, and they're supposed to be. They're designed to kill pests. That's why they are some of the most heavily regulated products in the marketplace. The state's regulatory program is designed to carefully manage these risks. We are proud of our robust regulatory system, in which the Minnesota Department of Agriculture works closely with the Department of Health, even sharing the same building, and the Pollution Control Agency. We believe we strike just the right balance between risk protection and monitoring the benefits to our farmers and our consumers. We prioritize human health and environmental protection and believe that we are running a very effective program. But you don't just have to take our word for it. There was this legislative audit that was done last year, and we do believe that it's fairly complementary of our program.
Thank you, Ms. Cheney.
I think there was one other person who wanted to speak in opposition. Let's do that. The committee, please state your name and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I would say not necessarily in opposition, but with concerns. And as this bill goes forward to Agriculture Committee, I've been speaking with Representative Schumper about this bill, and he's been very gracious with his time to speak about some of our concerns with it. My main concern is, farmers need some consistency in their planting decisions and when we're farming and making decisions. We have that right now. We don't, these are pesticides that are regulated every year. They've been regulated by the Department of Agriculture. We, in general, do not have a problem and do not see the Department of Agriculture as the fox watching the hen house. Although there may be cases where and individuals that do feel that way. But here in this bill, you are saying that all pesticide registration applications filed with the commissioner, and it's a lot, I believe it's thousands. And then also on 2.1, the Commissioner of Health has the final authority of whether those pesticides will be registered for use in the state, and restrictions placed on the pesticide use. So I'm just, concerned about, and would like to hear as we go through this committee and talk to the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture, that our growers are going to have some kind of assurances as to what the capacity of the Department of Health is, what the interest of the Department of Health is, and the assurances that they do this in a timely manner so that farmers can make their planting decisions and purchases and go on with it. And I just make a couple of comments about atrazine, since we're, just not to beat around the bush or anything, that, a lot of our members do use atrazine. They use it differently maybe than they did years ago. They use, they'll tell me they use ounces per acre now, not pounds per acre. They use it as a combination. And that's interesting too, when this bill came up before 2 years ago, when I polled my members that use atrazine, several of them actually told me they didn't use it anymore. And then maybe anywhere from a week to a month later, I saw them that summer, they'd say, I checked, or that mix I do have does contain some atrazine as one of the compounds. So I thought that was interesting. Some of our members do not want to use GMO corn products, and that is a lot of times the alternative to not using pesticides, and so that requires more GMO. What else would you end up using? And I'd also say not everybody loves atrazine. I don't want to give you that impression. We do have a lot of members who do not use it on their farm and do not want to use it on their farm. So I just wanted to add a couple of those comments. I hope they're somewhat helpful. And I'll continue to work with Representative Schumper as this goes to the Agriculture Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. So we had 10 minutes of testimony in favor and about 7 or 8 against. Let's try to, members, keep it under 10 minutes. We've heard a lot on this stuff already, so let's try to address the questions to the bill and kind of keep that in mind as we try to get through this 10 minutes of questioning. I have, on my list, Representative Eastland, did you still have a question?
I'll defer to Representative
McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Stoddard and Quinn, I apologize. I can't remember your last name, so I apologize. I didn't hear it. I tried. I whispered to everybody to get it. If you could identify for the tape so my poor landscaping ears could hear better, that'd be great.
Quinn Cheney.
Cheney. I'm sorry, Miss Cheney.
Department of Agriculture.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stoddard, based on the text of this bill, I was assuming you were going to say you were with the Department of Health. You listed all this experience you have in atrazine, and then you're a Department of Ag employee. I'm trying to figure out why would we, all the time we deal with the Department of Ag about pesticide application and those questions, all that expertise is at the Department of Ag. Why would we turn this over to the Department of Health? Are all the Department of Ag employees going to become Department of Health then? Because we need your expertise. The way you testified, I would think they would want your expertise to protect the folks at the Department of Health. And I'm trying to understand, Representative Schumper why would we not be doing these things in the department where all the expertise is, so we would have the science behind what we're doing and make conscious decisions that seem. I was impressed in the short, it wasn't three, it might have been 5 minutes, but it was very impressive. And then, especially Representative Shumper, you may mention yourself, we have an extremely long, and we have gotten some OLA reports that have been very alarming. This one absolutely basically tells the Department of Ag they're doing a terrific job with an issue that is really tough to deal with. I'm trying to understand why we don't want to keep it where the expertise is, so that we're making good decisions and with the folks that have the expertise.
Representative McNamara, and that.
Well,
I'm not sure if there's a question or a statement.
No, it's a question for all three of them, I would say, Mr. Chair. I want to know from the author the logic of going to the Department of Health when the expertise that testifies is from the Department of Ag, and we pay these fees. I mean, I'd love to ask Mr. Peterson or the other farmer from Land Stewardship, if they have a question. We have the Department of Ag's phone number in our shop or who to call if we have a pesticide question. I got to be honest, we don't have the Department of Health to call up and ask them if we've got a question about Snapshot or about atrazine. We know the Department of Ag, and they've been terrific resources for us. Are we afraid of their expertise? I mean, I'm trying to understand why we aren't working with what we have. We don't have an agency that's full of problems. I mean, my experience with this agency, and I fought with this agency, Representative Shumper, it's what got me involved in politics, and Mr. Bozicki could tell you, I have been banging on the table with the Department of Ag over some of their things. One of the things they don't do wrong is pesticide. And I'm trying to understand the logic of where we're coming from.
So, Representative McIntyre, if I can restate your question, I think you're looking for why would we want to move this from the Department of Ag to the Department of Health. Is that accurate?
Well, why don't we have the Department of Ag doing what the Department of Health is going
to
do?
Let's have the witnesses attempt to answer this question. Representative Shumper, you get first.
Okay, I thought I emphasized it several times in my presentation, Representative McIntyre. It's the health risk assessment. I don't think anybody in Ag Department would tell you that they are situated or capable of or have sufficient expertise to do health risk assessments. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about health risk assessments. What should drinking water standards be? What should other exposures be? Department of Agriculture registers pesticides, and if you read the OLA report, they're very perfunctory about it. They hardly ever turn down anyone. They accept the evidence from the Environmental Protection Agency. Oftentimes, they don't even require or request the documentation that the EPA has used. What we're saying here, again, based on a lot of peer-reviewed research, is that we need a higher level of scientific scrutiny, and the way to get that is to do it with risk assessment, which the health department does on the zillions of things, as we know from what's going on in the East Metro right now with the 3M problem there. They didn't call in the Department of Ag, they called in the Department of Health to do assessments there for health risks. And that's simply what we're saying here, okay? If you read the bill closely, the Department of Agriculture will continue to register the pesticides, okay? I don't know how I can be any more clear on that. We want to shift the focus of pesticide regulation from just a perfunctory role, which the old LA report documents, to a more risk assessment, science-based, higher level of science scrutiny role.
Representative Moe.
To that point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to Representative McNamara's point, and the Department of Ag maybe could speak to this, does the Department of Agriculture do long-term epidemiological studies about the health impacts of pesticides and herbicides? Does your department do that stuff currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, we do not have any health risk assessment staff.
Thank you.
Okay, so once again, Representative Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Shumper. I'm always a fiscal conservative here.
Aren't we all?
I'm just concerned because you commented about you want to transfer the burden to the Department of Health. Is there a fiscal note on this? And are they going, I mean, between the last two bills, which I'm not objecting to, but I'm just wondering, pretty soon this is going to be a lot for them to have to absorb.
I agree with you 100%. This bill, something similar to this bill was discussed a couple years ago. It had a fiscal note of $1.3 to $1.4 million, but I've been told my bill is much more expansive or extensive, and so the fiscal note would be much higher than that. I don't have a fiscal note, and as I think I've indicated, this is a work in progress. I suspect at some point in time we'll start to look at that. But I think we have to discuss it more, and I certainly want to have a lot more discussions with the Department of Health about this bill. There might be some savings from the Department of Ag side that would save us some money there. I'm not sure about that, and I certainly wouldn't guarantee that. But then you also get to the question of what's this going to be worth? I mean, if we just even remotely assume that Dr. Hayes is correct in most of his premise, and I think he's correct on all of it, isn't that something we want to invest money in at some point in time? I think we have to say what's our priority here, and if protecting health, especially young children's health and future generations' health, isn't a priority, well, then I guess it isn't. I think it will be if we can make the case for that. And again, this is a work in progress. I think another 6 months or a year of work on this bill will tell us a lot more, and certainly we'll have a lot better idea of the fiscal impact of it.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? I'm just wondering then, is this supposed to be in the appropriations for this next biennium then?
I don't believe it will be.
Okay.
It's going to Representative Junkie's Finance Committee, and I'm hoping we have a hearing there, but I don't anticipate it's going to be in any of the omnibus finance bills. So.
Thank you.
Representative Schumbach, one last short question. Representative Eastman?
Yeah, one last short amendment. Representative Shumper commented that his intent was not to take this away from the Department of Agriculture, but to bring some oversight into the health risk stuff from the Department of Health. And so I guess what I'd like to do is propose an amendment on line page 2, line 1, where it would read in the sentence in the middle of it, the Commissioner of Health may recommend to the Commissioner of Agriculture, who has the final authority on whether those pesticides may be registered for use in the state. So we would leave the authority for the recommendation of the registration with the Department of Ag, but we would include the Department of Health as being advisory to the Department of Ag with the health information. And I would just like to make that an amendment.
Okay, Representative Shumper to the amendment.
Yeah, I would be strongly against that amendment. The purpose here is to shift the authority to the Department of Health. If your amendment is currently policy with the Department of Ag, they do confer with the Department of Health. I think myself and other people that reviewed this with me, really want the lead role here to be with the Department of Health. Want the determination made on health risk assessment rather than, whatever assessment or baseline reasoning the Ag Department makes. I think part of this, what I certainly see as an inherent conflict of interest, the Ag Department's role, and I think they do it quite well in a lot of people's opinion, is to advocate for agriculture in this state. And,
Representative Shumper, thank you for your response. The amendment in front of you is the Eastland Amendment. Those of you in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not carry. Okay, then we have Representative Shumper's original amendment was to pass this and send it on to Finance, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm sure he renews his motion. Those in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion carries. Next on the agenda is Representative Dominguez here. Here he is. Representative
Representative Morgan. Would you care to move Representative Mingus's bill?
I would be happy to move House File 1809, and for if I could get some help on where this is going.
I believe this is in the omnibus bill, or would you like us to clear on its own?
Portion of it is in the omnibus bill, and portion of will go to, if it's passed, go to finance.
Oh my. Well, I'm going to need some advice then, because I don't know how to...
It's going to finance.
Okay.
So we are passing
for referral to finance.
Thank you. So, Representative Morgan moves that we pass this bill and send it to finance. Representative Dominguez, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity again for approaching you on another fine bill that I have in front of us. This is a safety net bill, and I just want to go over a little bit about the bill itself, give you a little introduction. Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net, community clinics, Hennepin County Medical Center, community mental health providers, visiting nurses, community dental clinic is in crisis due to the rapid growth of the uninsured and stagnant and declining revenue from the public and private funders. Many low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged Minnesotans will find themselves without health care options unless action is taken to save up some money for the safety net. Expanding health care coverage for the uninsured is important, but it needs immediate help and to preserve some of the clinics, such as North Point La Clinica, who just closed their clinic. It's a low-income clinic right on Lake Street, and I believe it is, help me here, Representative Clark, it's on Lake Street and Hiawatha, I believe it is, yes. And there's several other clinics that help low-income minority clients in those areas. So with that in consideration, I'm going to turn it over to our testifiers because I hear we don't have too much time. After that rumble that you just had, I hope we can get through this quickly. I'm going to turn it over to Michael here.
Before we do that, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill? Thank you very much. Let's try to limit our testimony to 10 minutes again. We're doing well with that, Mark.
We'll do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition. I do have some handouts to leave with you, if someone could distribute those, but I'll just get right into our explanation of the bill. First, there are some trends occurring among the uninsured that people probably are somewhat aware of, but the statistics about the rate of growth are really dramatic. For example, our uninsured population in Minnesota has increased by 23% in the last 5 years. The community clinics that serve low-income and uninsured people across the state have seen an increase of 43%. From 2002 to 2005. Another example, Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis has seen a 59% increase in the last 6 years in the cost of providing care to the uninsured. Revenues and income for the centers and funding that they're able to achieve is not keeping up with the growing number of uninsured patients. So something that we often take for granted in Minnesota, that everybody's going to be able to get health care somehow, even if they're uninsured, is no longer going to be an assumption that we can make unless we can find some way to keep the safety net operating while we see this growth in the number of uninsured. The bill has provisions in it that relate both to this committee's jurisdiction and also to Representative Huntley's Finance Division, so I'm just going to go over the sections of the bill that relate to this committee. First is Section 1 of the bill relates to e-health grants, and this is an existing program, and the funding is provided through this committee, grants to healthcare providers to upgrade their electronic health information systems and create electronic health records. What we're asking in the bill is to make it possible for the safety net clinics and providers to be able to receive those grants even if they're not part of a larger collaborative, which is one of the conditions under the current program. And so this would change the existing program to allow an individual community clinic or safety net provider to receive money out of that money that would be available in the budget so they could upgrade their electronic health records. On the next section that relates to this committee is section 4 of the bill. And this is language that requires the Commissioner of Health to do a study of the feasibility and potential funding sources for creating an uncompensated care fund that would be a fund of money that could be used to provide subsidies to the safety net providers to cover the costs of unreimbursed care provided to uninsured patients. Section 6 of the bill is language that would provide grants this year, or this biennium, to the safety net providers. We know that you have a lot of requests for funding and your money is limited, but if you're able to find some funding for the grants, we'd appreciate anything that you can provide that could be provided as a direct subsidy to the safety net providers that would help them keep afloat for a few more years until we can find more stable sources of funding. The final section, section 7, is the appropriations section, and subdivision 1 of section 7 relates to loan forgiveness programs, and this is another general budget item that this committee deals with. What we're asking here is if there is possible to provide additional funding beyond the base level for loan forgiveness programs that could be targeted for the safety net providers so that if they can't find a dentist or if they can't find a primary care physician, they may be able to help make it more attractive to providers to practice there by providing some forgiveness of their medical school and dental school loans. If there is not enough money to earmark for this, we'd ask whether some of the existing dollars could be targeted for this purpose. In subdivision 2 of the appropriations section are the appropriations for the electronic medical record grants and grants for the subsidies to the safety net providers. With that, I will turn the table over to Jonathan Watson, who is with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give testimony.
My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for providing me this opportunity today. There should be a packet that you have with a color chart on the front of it, and let me just go through this real quick. We do represent 19 what are called community health centers. We provide a medical home for 180,000 Minnesotans throughout the state. We are part of the safety net that Mr. Scandrett's referring to. You can just look at our demographics. 42% of our patients are uninsured. That's almost six times the state rate. If you look at beneath that poverty, 86% of our patients have incomes below 200% of poverty. And by race and ethnicity, our patients obviously look a lot different than the general population. Only 34% of our patients are white. We are located in the next couple slides. You can see where our locations are throughout the state and also in the Twin Cities metropolitan region. Let me just make sure you all know, too, that although that these are located in certain areas, we do draw from a variety of different communities. For example, many of the inner city clinics draw from Bloomington and Richfield and Woodbury and some of the suburban communities for those folks that don't have insurance, so it is an access point. Let me just move on why I'm here today. Obviously, to support House File 1809, since a lot of these provisions would assist us in our mission in providing health care for the uninsured. Specifically, Section 6, these grants would cover the cost of unreimbursed costs, rather, for our service to the uninsured. And why we're here is we're really at a tipping point. If you look on slide 3, it just goes to show the general trend in the uninsured using community health centers over the last 6 or 7 years. We've seen a 43% increase since 2001. Nearly one out of every six uninsured persons in the state of Minnesota uses a community health center. Particularly distressing is the triangles on this chart. It's the number of uninsured children. That increased about 24% in 2005 versus 2004. We just about have 2006 data in, and it's looking at similar trends. So we do serve one out of every four uninsured child in the state of Minnesota. Right now, for every encounter we have for an uninsured person, we have to scramble to find roughly $40 per patient. Right now, the patients themselves pay part of it, about 20% of every dollar we spend on the uninsured, and the federal government assists us partially too. However, we do have to find $40 worth of care worth of revenue to cover that cost. We do that through private foundations and local grants. However, the state of Minnesota has never been a partner at that table yet, and that's why we're here today. You may ask, why do we attract so many uninsured? Real quickly, on charts 4 and 5, I'm sorry, chart 4 is just a snapshot of our revenue versus our cost. And you can see this gap has been widening over the last few years. Our costs are obviously going up much faster than our revenue. But in terms of why we attract so many uninsured, chart 3 on page 5, what's unique to Community Health Center is we provide what are called enabling services. These could be transportation or language interpretation services. This is the highest growth cost growth center for our community health centers. It's increased 13.2%, nearly double our total costs. So what our business model is to go out and enable those folks that face barriers to health care, often without insurance, to come in and receive primary preventative care. The second piece, as I mentioned before, patients in the last slide, patients do contribute to the cost of their care. However, the amount that they contribute peaked in about 2001. It's dropped about 23%. They're charged on a sliding fee schedule, and they contributed about 27% in 2001. That's down to about 20% of the cost of care. So we're seeing poorer and poorer patients. So these statistics are kind of dry and boring, but let me just give you four examples of what all these put together mean. The Coop Clinic in South Minneapolis recently closed 22 outreach sites. Representative Dominguez did refer to La Clinica closing. 5,200 folks needed to find culturally appropriate care somewhere else in the cities. Family Health Care in Moorhead closed last year. 2,500 folks needed to find alternative care for themselves. Sawtooth Mountain up in the Arrowhead, they just recently suspended services in Toffee. 500 patients again affected. And lastly, the Cedar Riverside People's Center. They are scaling back a lot of their popular services, the translator services and the patient education. 92% of their patients need those services, but for business decisions, they have to scale those back. So again, we support the intent of House File 1809 for all the good things it does, but we feel Section 6 does make the necessary investment into the infrastructure of the community of healthcare safety net. I'm available for any questions. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Watson.
Thank you.
Questions from the members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the map, you know, of the clinics, and you've mentioned a number of them that are having financial trouble and that sort of thing. There's quite a concentration of them in the metro area on the one side, which obviously is the larger population. But I guess I'm just looking at the options for, you know, outstate people who would fall in the category of poverty that we're talking about here. I mean, if you live in southern Minnesota, you got one option, and you might have to drive 200 miles to get there. You know, I guess I looked in the statute, and it's not referred to in the subdivision 1, but it's referred to in subdivision 2. Of the statute of community license of community clinic grants, and it says, and shall ensure geographic representation in grant awards among all regions of the state. And I guess, what are we doing to make sure that we provide access for some of the other more remote regions of the state that also have people that need to access affordable health care?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative, just to reiterate, this is just one piece of the community health care safety net. You know, there's a whole system of about 58 rural health clinics that are out there, and they do accept folks that don't have insurance. They're not required by law to have a sliding fee schedule to provide access to folks. So it's a little bit different model, but they're out there. There's also, obviously, emergency rooms and things like that in the rural areas that are taking people in. But you're exactly right. We've worked with the federal government under the Bush administration to double the number of community health centers in the state of Minnesota. We've added 3 over the last 4 years. Unfortunately, they've all been in the metropolitan areas. The way the federal government scores these applications is geared particularly against the Midwestern states due to our demographics, our white population, if you will, our age expectancy, and our low birth weight babies. Those indicators are all good for us, but bad for receiving federal funds. So that's been one of our frustrations, is trying to get partnering with the state to develop more community health centers throughout the state.
Thank you.
I guess I go back to my question is, if this bill is passed, how much money is it going to cost, and how far will it go in addressing that broader, will this do anything to help? You listed some, the one up in Cook County, and there's a number of us up at Grand Marais that are having trouble, that are closing. So what would this bill do to ensure that we broaden that thing on geographically across the state? Maybe you could comment on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, what this bill does is try to keep open the clinics that are currently in existence. That we would love to talk to you and the committee about funding some expansion to additional clinics. I think they're needed. But right now we're just trying to avoid losing more rather than asking you for money for added clinics.
I guess what I'm getting at is, thank you, Mr. Chair, I think you said that some had closed. Would this bill open those clinics that have closed?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe so.
Okay,
thank you.
Representative Clark, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask about the clinics that have closed and also some of the outreach services that have been cut back and what hope they might be for restoring some of those in those communities that have lost so much.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, yes, I think in some instances those like Cedar Riverside People's Center and Community University Healthcare Center, the amount of money to start a new clinic is a tremendous amount of money. I don't think the money contained in this bill could do that, but it could go a long way to restoring those services. That would be something. Also, adding providers that they may have had to let go over the last few years, adding capacity or dental services, mental health services.
Thank you.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this would be to any of the testifiers here. Minnesota is ranked number one for coverage for health care. I mean, we cover more than any other state. We just implemented the 2% MCHA, the tax on medical providers for this very purpose, to cover. And I'm just wondering, are your facilities doing the 90-day residency requirement when someone comes in to make sure that they are, in fact, Minnesota residents for at least 90 days when they come in and seek services?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in terms of the 90-day residency requirement, our clinics do assist with the enrollment procedure and submit the application to the Department of Human Services for eligibility. They do serve the folks in real time. So if it comes back that they're not compliant with that, we just absorb that as an uninsured patient. Am I answering your question? Or I'm not that knowledgeable about the intake and enrollment process in our clinics. So.
And Mr. Chair, and to that point, I think we have a system that is serving everybody that's coming in. In fact, my area does not have one of these, but they do have a community hospital that really pays. Last year they lost $6 million in terms of reimbursed expenses. And it's a community hospital. They serve everyone. And so I get a little frustrated, and I think the taxpayers get a little frustrated when we've got an open system that serves everybody that comes in, and then we come up to the table and we say, we need some more money to open up these other clinics so that it can serve other people who are not even checking to see if they're residents. And before I even ran for office, I started reading some of this stuff, to be quite honest, and it was just like, where are we going with this? Because we have a healthcare entitlement system that's open to the rest of the nation, in essence. And so we cannot continue to fund this stuff unless we have some control, some restraints on this, and say, we are going to service our people. Now, I understand there's a compassionate heart for Minnesotans, but at some point, when we get into a growth rate of 24% on the biennium, in terms of what we're doing for this healthcare, we got to say, we got to pull in ropes, folks. We got to stop at some point. And I guess I'm just trying to verbalize some of my frustrations with this whole situation. And I think that if we get a fiscal note on this, we may be able to say, yes, this is something we can program into it. But what are we looking at down the road in terms of meeting these needs? And that's kind of what we're looking for here.
Any of the testifiers like to comment on that?
Representative, yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Representative, one thing, as a condition of us receiving the federal grant, we do have to serve all people regardless of their situation. So if we were to start turning people away because we suspect that they not be here legally, we would run into a lot of troubles with our federal grant. Also, the second thing is our clinics are at capacity in terms of medical provisions, and the waiting rooms are full. We really don't have the staff
to judge people's immigration status. I think the medical providers feel that's not their role.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just change the topic. I look at the list of metro clinics and I see two names that I'm quite familiar with. One of the things that I know happened this last year with the influenza was that it was my understanding the state health department wasn't really as at the table as much as they could have or should have been because they didn't have funding for the serum. And yet there were nonprofit organizations out there in these clinics and did 5,000 and 6,000 free inoculations, and I know they were over what people, and I know that the North Point was involved. In this program, is there going to be enough resources that if we were to replicate this year, that you could step in with influenza vaccine to help start doing free clinics and inoculations? Because we had 4 deaths this year of children in these populations. Maybe I'm clear off on in a different world than what you're talking to, but that's kind of where I am at this point. The question is influenza this year, resources to help fill that need if we see the same thing happening again next
year. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think our clinics, I speak on behalf of them, would be more than happy if resources were available, that we would absolutely be an access point to give vaccine out, absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you for the questions and testimony. Representative Morgan, I'm sure, renews his motion to pass this bill out of committee and send it to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Next on the list, we have Representative Cornish. House File 2161. Representative Cornish, let me see. The chair will move Representative Cornish's bill. And I believe you're looking for inclusion into our omnibus bill. Is that correct?
I believe so. Held over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
I will make that motion. Your bill, Mr. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, House File 2161, if it's okay with you folks, if I could make a couple small amendments, oral amendments. You'll notice on line 1.6 of the bill, there's a blank for appropriations. I'd like to put $1.5 million into that blank. And then further down the line on 1.6, if you would cross out the word health and put human services. If you could move that amendment for me, then
I will move that amendment. Let's have staff just read it back just so we're all familiar with what we're doing here.
Page
1, line 6, after the dollar sign, insert $1.5 million. And same line,
delete health and
insert
human services.
Any discussion to the amendment? Representative
Farland. Mr. Chair, does that mean that this is under the Department or the Health and Human Services Committee's jurisdiction then?
I believe so.
Representative
Clark.
Change there? Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Has this bill been to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee?
I believe this is the first stop.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, the advice to go to Human Services came, I presume, from... where did the advice to change this to the Commission of Human Services come from?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Chuck Nordwig.
He's still the chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just out of there for a minute. My name is Chuck Nordwig. I'm the state meth coordinator based out of the Department of Health, and I've been working closely with Senator Julie Rosen on this. The she's interested in having the Department of Human Services because there's a potential funding stream ongoing down the road. So that's the intent of this.
Thank you.
Oh, it doesn't say here.
Okay, then.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would suggest the motion should be changed to this bill, then when it passes to finance, and then from finance it would be going back to the Department of, to the Committee on Department of Human Services.
Having that discussion, then the chair who originally had that motion will retract that motion and make a better motion to have this passed from this committee and sent to back to finance.
As amended.
As amended. We do need to run through the amendment first. Are there any discussions to the amendments? I think we got everything figured out. Those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So we do have the bill now in submitted form. To the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, what this bill is last, in the session 2005, there was a appropriation for $1.5 million. $750,000 each year that went out to counties for methamphetamine treatment. And priority was for those counties that demonstrate a treatment program that incorporates the best practices defined in the human services. And that's why we changed it to human services, because they're close tied to the mental health services. This would, in your handout, you show the programs that are currently existing. From the 2005 appropriation. This appropriation is also about the same, $750,000 each year to go out to these agencies. And if you ask, I would imagine what I would thought you might ask is why these? And these counties were picked in these programs for their ongoing successfulness. And they're just now starting to track data coming back from these programs. And so we wanted to continue on with it. And if you'll notice, it's pretty long-term treatment, like drug treatment should be. That we're acknowledging that it's not just a spin dry like the old days. This is quite lengthy treatment. And these are special clientele that come into these programs. And I've left my testifiers behind. I thought that unless you run into a question, I can't answer. So that's the bill in the short form.
Any questions to this? Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish, I just want to rise in support of this. I have a niece who needed to get into meth treatment, and it was very hard to find a place in Minnesota that could actually specialize in this area. And so I really do appreciate this coming forward.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, members, I think we're realizing finally we can't just lock everybody up and let them go. That we have to incorporate, if it's going to be incarceration, with some treatment afterwards. And this is not only to do with the correction system. This is general human services clientele, too, that would come in. Anybody could use this.
Representative Cornish, if anybody knew you, they would know that that's a strong statement coming from you. The need for treatment.
Well, my first human services bill ever.
And I wanted to add, as a representative of Anoka County and a high school teacher, I know the need is great in our community, so I support and probably will be looking to add my name to your bill. So those in favor of this bill, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries and it passes.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Clark. A couple of bills here. In there, members, I think we must be getting close to the end because the gallery is emptying back there. I see.
Come on, everybody want to stand up for like a minute and take a stretch.
Representative Clark, I'm going to assume that we're going to stay in order and you're going to be making comments on House File 1623.
Right, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 1623 first and go for film perpetual.
Where are we moving it to?
And, Mr. Chairman, it'll be layover and the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And maybe I'll just go right to my witness. I think we can make this. Basically, what we're trying to do is make sure that the very unmet need for dental care among children is begun to be addressed. It still doesn't pretend to be meeting all the needs, but we have a very successful program that operates in St. Paul right now, and we want to expand it to the sister city of Minneapolis. And I would like to ask my witness to go ahead and describe.
Representative Clark, I understand we have an amendment.
And there is an amendment. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, would you like to take the amendment now, or would you like to do that later?
Let's hear the program first, and then we'll...
Okay.
That's all right.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm an employee of Greater Twin Cities United Way, and we're here to speak in favor of Representative Clark's bill. Just a brief overview of why United Way is interested in this and has gotten involved in St. Paul and what we see as the funding implications. As she has pointed out, this is a program to address severe dental problems in very young children. The U.S. Department of Human Services has said that the most common unmet treatment need in children is dental care. And the Center for Disease Control in 2005 reported that there is a 15% increase in youngest children with severe dental problems. By the youngest children is children ages 2 to 5, and we've seen a comparable local experience. We also know that 51 million school days per year nationally are lost because children are out of school because of what are essentially unplanned dental problems. This is not scheduled visits to the dentist. What is particularly disturbing about all of this is that virtually all of these problems are 100% preventable. Children from low-income families, communities of color, recent immigrants, and refugees are significantly more likely to go without any kind of dental care than the rest of the population. In 2004, we started a program with some startup funding in St. Paul, ultimately secured additional funding and expanded this program to all of Ramsey County. Last year, we took care of 4,000 kids with severe dental problems. I know you have a handout. Is it been handed out? Yes. Okay. And then this is some larger versions of those pictures. Each of these mouths that you see is a child under 5 from the Twin City metropolitan area. Obviously, most of us would like the lower, my left-hand corner, to be our kid. The rest of these are examples of children that we have seen in the last 2 years in our pilot project in St. Paul. The idea behind this program was to do a project or a pilot project in the Minneapolis area. The thing I want to point out to the committee and ultimately to the entire legislature is that this is a startup or pilot project without tails. We will not be back here asking you for ongoing funding for this program. And the money will not go to support United Way expenses that are involved in making this program work. All of the staff time, all of the out-of-pocket expenses for United Way will come out of the annual campaign and special grants that we get from foundations. The money for this program will go to outreach workers and the dental hygienists to bring the families who need this care and don't recognize the need that they have for their children into the program. You might ask, why not just take the St. Paul model, drop it into the Minneapolis area, and not worry about a pilot project? Well, unfortunately, we're dealing with entirely different populations, not only in terms of the families that we would be working with, but also the dental providers. One of the things that we know about Minneapolis, which we think is particularly disturbing, is that only 26% of kids on Minnesota Care, ages 4 to 6, accessed any dental care at all in 2004 from the city of Minneapolis. This compares to 41% statewide. These families simply are not getting it. We would use the money to work in three Minneapolis neighborhoods near North, the Phillips Powderhorn, and University Communities, then expand it to all of Minneapolis and ultimately Hennepin County without more state funding. We do this with our local agencies by reaching out to families. We will do this with local dental clinics, providing care and educating parents, and local funders to keep this project going. And with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lair. Well done. Representative Ferguson.
Question. Maybe if opening a box I shouldn't open up. Would it be beneficial for you to specify that this dental providers could include licensed dental hygienists?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, we would be using a dental hygienist as part of our project, and that person would be licensed. And we do use a licensed dental hygienist in St. Paul.
Any other questions to the bill? Representative McFarland.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and to the presenter. You said that this is just one-time money sent for this, and then United Way will pick it up?
Mr. Lair, Representative McFarland, yes. We will not be back here asking for additional funding.
So the dental health coordinator position, is that just for 2 years?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions to the bill?
Mr. Representative,
you've got two funding in here. I'm sorry. I misspoke. The Section B is a different appropriation. The Section A appropriation would be for just 2 years. I'll let Representative Clark address that second section.
Yep. Representative Clark?
Representative McFarland, the project says on line 2.28, $100,000. That is to restore a position that we used to have at the Minnesota Department of Health. It's been empty a little while. I'm not sure exactly how long. But we're interested in restoring it. And one of the reasons is we don't want to have little pilot projects like this all over. We want it to have the whole state eventually be able to have the kind of dental health care that
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. So would this person also be coordinating other health programs, dental health programs that are already out there? I know Century College has a weekend a year that they do this type of thing. Would they help with that sort of thing also?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, we're not prescribing exactly what they would do. We just know that this is a position that would probably do that sort of thing, but also, you know, we have a very big need for dental health care in the state. We'd want them to be actually, hopefully, even working to bring in federal dollars and, coordinating a number of different resources.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Representative Clark, to your amendment.
Maybe Representative Moore. Sorry.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clark, I'd like to move Amendment H1623A1, and maybe we can speak to it. Representative Clark, first I thank you for bringing this forward. And your bill actually was brought to my attention from my own dentist.
Mm-hmm.
He said,
Was it when he had you in the chair?
No, he told me. He said, have you seen Representative Clark's bill? My dentist, John Luth in Bemidji, is part of a dental access team in Bemidji area who, well, again, our districts are very similar in that you have the largest number of underserved kids. We have the largest geographic area of underserved kids. Mm-hmm. So because of the low compensation rates for medical assistance, children in Bemidji, on Roadside Preservation, Red Lake, or White Earth have to travel over 150 miles to actually get to a dentist, which will serve them. A collaboration has come together to actually come up with bringing the dentist the dental school at the University of Minnesota, to have interns come up to help provide care, and the technical college to actually also do with the service that you're trying to provide here with your bill. So I think this would be a friendly amendment. We would be making also the Bemidji area eligible. And I did insert a number 248.5. I've looked at the Senate bill. In the Senate bill, our group has asked for $160,000 to fund their startup costs. That would change the amendment 1.7 from inserting 2485 to inserting 333 2500. So there'll be one small oral amendment change, Mr. Chair.
Could you repeat that?
On line
of the amendment.
Of the amendment, line 1.7, instead of inserting 248500, we would insert 333500.
Okay, any discussion to Representative Moe's oral amendment in changing lines in line 1.7 from 248,500 to 333,500? All those in favor of that oral amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion carries. See the amendment.
No.
How much does it cost to get St. Cloud in?
Mr. Chairman, Edward Peterson, I think if you can put together the kind of collaboration that we were just hearing about, I would encourage you to bring it back next year.
We do need to move the amendment, though.
So, I thought we could.
I don't think we've moved the amendment.
Oh, okay.
So, maybe.
I'm not sure. I thought Representative Moe moved it, but I will be happy to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, the A1 amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We got it done. Now to the bill as amended. I think we've gone through the testimony and questions. Those of you to the entire bill, I guess we don't have to worry about it. It's laid up in that omnibus bill. Moving right along.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some witnesses
are
here.
2258.
Chairman, I'd like to move House 2258, and I'll pass around the map here.
And where are we moving this, Representative Clark? This is the omnibus bill
right
as well.
Right here in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry this is all kind of wound up here, but I'd like to pass around this, and you can open it up and look. Mr. Chairman, what I'm asking this committee to do is to help us who live in the area that's next to what's known as the Arsenic Triangle. And the reason this little map is going around so you can see what the Arsenic Triangle is, it's an area that used to be an industrial site, used to be a arsenical pesticide manufacturing plant years ago, and on the map you see there's an open space at the bottom. If you look at the density of the housing around there, and the reason for this bill is that that plant, which was operating there in the 30s up to the late 60s, and then discovered in the 90s as a, which was now actually called a Superfund site because it was full of arsenical pesticide right on the ground, going down into the ground and heading into the aquifer and creating a plume that's moving towards the Mississippi River. But the part that you need to know about is that for all the years that that plant was there, and the pesticide was being loaded off of railroad tracks that go by, and this was pesticide that was used to deal with grasshoppers and other sort of things along the railroad tracks. That pesticide was blowing around the neighborhood. And look at the houses there. Very dense neighborhood. And so we have been in a process in South Minneapolis in this neighborhood with dealing with a Superfund site in the heart of a very dense population that has needed to, first of all, they identified that there were problems with arsenic on many of our yards, a level that was considered acute. I can tell you that one day I had to go home from the legislature a couple years ago in April, and when I arrived at my door, I was met by, I think, about five people who were in white suits with respirators and hats and booties and gloves, and they were there to take the arsenic off my own front yard. I was the 30th of 29 yards that had the arsenic removed, had the soil removed, starting at the curb 12 inches, going up to my house 18 inches. I was just one of 30. Now they've identified hundreds of homes and potentially thousands of homes that need to have the arsenic removed from the yards. And what this bill is saying is that we want our health department to help us understand what the health risks are, first of all. It's been very, very frustrating. We've had numerous meetings with the federal EPA coming in. After all, they've declared this a Superfund site. They haven't been able to quite figure out what to call the whole neighborhood. It's in line to be called a broader Superfund site. They're still deciding what to call it. They do tell us, though, that we have these emergency situations at a certain level of soil contamination. But we have not been able to get really clear about what the health risks are. And so we're asking in this bill for the Commissioner of Health Commissioner of Health to work with our PCA and help us understand what the health risk standards are. I can tell you that the arsenic in my yard was 125 parts per million. The level at which they're taking the arsenic off the yards is 95 parts per million. The danger is for mostly little children playing in yards, going out, getting arsenic on their skin, getting it in their mouth and lungs. My neighbor next to me, his soil was tested at 70 parts per million. But they're not touching his yard. You know why? There's no health standard for children right now. He takes care of three little grandchildren who are toddlers. The day I came home and in the following week and I would come back and visit my own yard, the children next door would be outside with their grandpa. And I felt one of them was just learning to walk. So he was falling down, getting up, and so on. That yard is not being cleaned up. We have no standard to tell us what's safe for those children. So we want that to change. It's kind of similar to what some of the people in Eastern Metro are dealing with. We have a dangerous toxin right within our midst, and we don't have real clarity on what the standards are. The standards that we're told are 95 parts per million are not acceptable to the people in the neighborhood, when we know that our commercial sites have been cleaned up to 30 parts per million in some cases and 20 parts per million in others. Why are we asked to live with 95 parts per million? So that's one of the questions. And we're asking also that there be medical testing for the pesticide among the people who are living there. Folks go to their doctors, and the doctors don't know what to do. They don't know much about this testing. We want our health department to take some leadership, help us figure out what should the test be. And then there are others who are concerned about just even getting their yards tested, because not every yard is tested. It's within a mile that we're asking here that we make sure that yards can be tested. The final part of this is an evaluation to try to ask our Department of Health to understand what are the cumulative health impacts of having this kind of arsenical pesticide in a community that also has a heavy load of lead, has mercury in the air, has a lot of different sort of problems. And putting that all together is what we're asking. And we would like the children and the others who are eligible for medical assistance to be able to have that covered by, the arsenic system covered by that. That's about, there's a lot of feeling to the community about this. It's been going on for a couple of years now. And I'd like to ask, maybe start with Council Member Schiff here, who represents part of the community, to a little bit more than one of our neighbors.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. We are going to try to keep it to a total of 10 minutes, as much as possible.
That's plenty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representatives, for your time this afternoon. My name is Gary Schiff, and I represent the area that includes the Arsenic Triangle. And altogether in my ward, 3,575 properties have been tested for arsenic contamination in the past few years. Six of those properties registered with levels of over 1,000 parts per million. 95 of the 197 properties that qualify for emergency cleanup have been cleaned up so far. Another 102 will be cleaned up this summer. We're only in the first tier of emergency cleanup as approved by the EPA. What happens after this is figuring out where between the level considered to be background, safe, 10 parts per million, and 95, that level of medium cleanup is still to be determined. And in the meantime, my office hears all the time anecdotal information from residents about children coming in with high levels of arsenic testing. And I want to share with you the experience of one of my constituents. Her name is Chris. Her child was tested voluntarily. She brought him to the doctor, and he had arsenic levels in his blood 50% higher than what's average for his age. Normal blood level, according to the physician, was 0.08. Her son came in at 0.12. She moved into her home in Phillips during the first trimester. Her son, Isaac, who tested high, now has autism. Her other son has a developmental disability. It has been determined by physicians that neither of these conditions are genetic in origin. There's a lot of fear. Chris and her son's experience are not the only ones, but we have no standards. We have no overall reaching way to tell parents to get their child tested, and that's what we need, and that's why I ask for your support. This is also one of the poorest neighborhoods in the state of Minnesota, one of the second highest concentrations of poverty in the city of Minneapolis. And for that reason, we're dealing with populations that are subject to other health risks as well and have the least ability to be able to pay for this type of testing, which today is considered discretionary. So I ask for your support so that we can get these children the urgent help they need. And Carol Pass from East Phillips Neighborhood has specific information about the number of children living in poverty in this affected area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for letting me speak today. My name is Carol Pass, and I am the president of the East Phillips Improvement Coalition, the neighborhood organization, and I live at 2546 18th Avenue South. And just listening to this, I mean, I know this, but it's almost making me sick to listen to it because I have a granddaughter there, and I'm very close to many of the people there. We have about a 75% minority rate, and they include every minority you can imagine. But one thing you should know is that there has been a 48% increase since the previous census up to 2000 in families with kids. We have the greatest growth in population. I mean, we're the reason Minneapolis is holding its own. And we also have about 40% of those kids in East Hills living, and that's the closest one to the Arsenal Triangle, living in poverty, and about 35% in the next part of Phillips over. And we also have probably the largest in Minneapolis of the sensitive populations, the old and the little kids. So I' 'm looking at 43% increase in children up between the ages of 14 to 19, and about a 40% increase in children from about maybe 10 to, and then beyond that it's another 40%. So we have this. I'll just tell you frankly, I'm just going to sort of speak from the heart here. This is the area where the refugees, this is the entry, this is the Ellis Island, you could say, of the Midwest. And it's that way naturally because it's poor and because people can actually own their own home in this spot. And the idea that we're bringing them into something called the Arsenic Triangle, I don't want this area to just vacate and turn into a wasteland, but if people hear much about this, they'll flee. But where do they flee? Because the houses are all, you move out of there and the price of housing goes up about double. So we have offered the, you know, bring me your poor, your whatever, and we are subjecting them to what really is a poisoned area. And I find that this is a serious moral issue. I mean, it isn't just a budgetary or science deal. It's a serious moral issue. And we really need to respond because we've got these people coming. We're not going to stop them coming. And they're wonderful people. They do all the hard, heavy work in Minneapolis. And their children are not cared for because we've got this issue. It's very frightening. It's very disturbing. I want them to be able to know what's going on, but more than that, you know, if you tell everybody this and you don't do anything, I don't know what will happen. It's quite frightening. I want this to be responded to and taken care of. I want the yards to be cleaned up, and I want you all to take this on as a serious moral issue for the legislature. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Clark.
Chairman, I move the bill, and there were a number of people who were here earlier had to leave, but I think you've heard a good representative.
Oh, wait a minute.
Oh,
you're back.
Here. I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Okay. I'd like to say one more for this.
Hi, my name is Cecilia Martinez. My professional position is I'm a senior policy fellow for the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy, but I also work on a project that is about organizing and giving access to information about the arsenic issue to the Phillips community. I want to give a little bit of history in terms of why some of the community people who wanted to be here but can't be here, why they think this is an important issue for them. While Phillips is high poverty in terms of its composition, I'd also like to offer an alternative picture of it. It is a location where the urban native community has found its home for many, many years, and obviously if we look back enough in history, we know that this area was home to indigenous communities well before the state of Minnesota was an official state. Having said that, this urban relocated, urban native population has
lived in that area since approximately World War II, when a significant number moved to that area. It is considered home to them. They were the people who were living adjacent to the pesticide plant, and as best as we can tell, they were also the people that were working on, in the pesticide plant as well when that was in operation. As you've already heard testimony, the finding of the arsenic was in 1994. The levels on the site were as high as 20,000 micrograms per kilogram. You've heard that the referent value is 35 micrograms per kilogram. The arsenic has been growing in the neighborhood for well over 40, 50 years into the residential yards of the community. A number of organizations from the community have come together to try and figure out why they're not being provided access to information on a widespread basis. Among those are the American Indian Center, the Healthy Nations Program, the Native American Community Clinic, the Indian Health Board, North American Water Office, Indigenous Peoples Task Force, and Healthy Nations Program, which deals with youth in the neighborhood. They have begun to meet, and they have begun to ask the questions of, as to why their community, when it is a high child community and a high community with elders who are have the sensitive body burden population, why some of their concerns have not been addressed. What they are asking for, and we just had another meeting this week, is that the state recognize that they need to have some screening done to their kids, for their kids and their families. They do not know what the body burden is right now, having lived in those yards that have high levels. They would like to know what it is. What is it that their children are facing, whether in fact they do have contamination in their system, and what they can do about it. Native American Community Clinic is very willing to step forward and be an access point in order to help the screening happen, as is Indian Health Board. They also directly asked for remediation of properties. As was stated before, the federal kick in the monies is at 95. However, the safe referent value is 35, which means that we have a gap in terms of access of monies to help remediate the yards that that may have pose a health risk to these kids. In the earlier testimonies of earlier bills, I heard about the cumulative or additive effects of contamination. This is a neighborhood that very seriously faces those issues. With the high arsenic, which has just been known recently, the high lead issue that was in the past, we are also finding that approximately two-thirds of the land within Phillips has some sort of contamination on it. That's part of our research. The additive effects of all these contaminations pose some serious public health risks, we believe, for the community. So on behalf of the Phillips community, on behalf of those people who weren't able to make it today, we seriously hope you consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martinez. Any other questions from members? Okay, with that, then this bill is laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I might add that the the fiscal note is coming. You don't have it yet.
Okay.
Thank you. She doesn't have a copy of Senate Bill 357, but Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that.
Okay. The chair moves. Actually, Representative Clark moves.
Yeah, that's okay.
Speak for myself here. But, Representative Clark moves that I believe House Senate file 357 be included, I think.
Yes, it would be laid over for inclusion.
I'll move this bill, possible inclusion. Okay.
No, actually, I believe this one would not, Mr. Chairman. This one would be going...
Local government?
It'll be going to local government, correct.
Okay. So the official motion in front of us that then Representative Clark make is that we pass Senate File 357 from this committee and refer it to GovOps.
Local government.
Local government. Somebody
there
like that.
Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by my senator. He was Senator Bergman has some concerns and identified this as a problem dealing with affordable housing and a barrier, and I would like to introduce.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Matt Socek. I am a Housing Development Project Manager with Project for Pride and Living. We're a nonprofit housing developer and service provider in South Minneapolis. For those of you who might not be familiar with our organization, we've developed over 400 units of ownership housing since 1972, many of those units on previously tax-forfeited lots in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We at PPL support Senate File 357. I'd like to thank Representative Clark for putting it forward here. Charging affordable housing developers such as PPL a market price for publicly controlled land in a project that is otherwise publicly subsidized has the effect of taking money from one public pocket and effectively putting it in another. It also greatly challenges affordability. I'd offer you an example. It costs our organization and many other nonprofits approximately $180,000 to build a quality, affordable home that conforms to most urban neighborhoods. If we sell that home at that cost, and I stress that that's cost, to a buyer of approximately 60% of the area median income, and that buyer mortgaged $175,000 of that cost, their monthly PITI would be approximately $1,400 per month. This number would represent approximately 34% of that buyer's monthly income, and that would barely be considered affordable, and that's just at cost. You add in approximately $30,000 for land acquisition, now you've got a total development cost of $215,000. The buyer takes a mortgage of $210,000, and that mortgage represents about 42% of that buyer's monthly payment, about $1,650 per month. That home is no longer affordable. And then, again, I stress that that's just at cost. To make homes affordable in these situations, what we often do is we'll request affordability gap dollars from the state, the city, and the county. What those dollars effectively do is buy down the amount of money that the buyer would otherwise have to mortgage to help keep it affordable. But the reality is that when we do that, what we're really doing is taking those dollars out of one public pocket and putting it into another to subsidize the cost of the land. If there is no affordability dollars available for us in those circumstances, there may be no affordable housing opportunity. Senate File 357 could certainly help nonprofits like ours make many more affordable housing opportunities available. I ask that you help us to continue to help you in attaining the state's affordable housing goals and support Senate File 357. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Representative Clark, is there an amendment that we have on this?
I believe it's Representative Eastland's amendment. It's not my amendment.
Yep. Right. Okay, Representative Eastland, to your amendment.
Well, could I ask a question or two about the bill first?
You certainly can.
Okay.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have one question, Representative Clark, in the first line 1.8. It says, if a nonprofit organization receives funds from the agency, who is the agency?
Chairman, I believe it's the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. 462 refers to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
Okay, I thought it was okay. And then I guess I'd like to move ahead and maybe I'd offer the, is it the A1 amendment, is the number? And
yes, it is.
I'd like to offer that amendment. I'd just like to speak to why. I understand what the bill is, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, because I think it's a good thing. It's important that we get some of this net land that needs to be redeveloped, and we need to get it turned into affordable housing. But I mean, as I look at this, I think there could be some consequences that are unintended by your the way you've got this written, because the cost of to the county or city for acquisition of the property, I'm not sure what that means, but I think that could mean, if it's interpreted the way I think it would be interpreted legally, the city's investment in that property, or the government agency's investment in that property. It's conceivable that a city could have more invested in a piece of property than it's worth. if it's very dilapidated, if there's some kind of an environmental cleanup process that had to be gone through. And I guess I'm looking at this, and what I did was I went and looked at another affordable housing program, the HUD program, to see what they do in the way they value things. And the way HUD values their homes is they base their value on an appraisal conducted by an independent real estate appraiser. And so it seems to me that if a government agency is going to do due diligence to the properties that they're dealing with, that should be the starting point. And so I guess what I put in my amendment was that that really what we should be basing the transfer price on is the market value based on an appraisal. The city doesn't have to take that, but that's the most that they could take. That's the absolute most that they could take. And then they could agree to take anything less than that that they would want to, to help the project go on. And the other reason, and the other part of my amendment is on 113. The county, I wonder what you mean by this. The county or city must waive all development and other fees related, all the plan review fees, the building permit fees, the sack and whack fees, the green space fees. There's tons and tons of fees that cities provide that are real costs for the city. And I mean, I guess my question is, where are the cities? Well, how do the cities feel about this, or the counties? How do they feel about having to, just be put in statute that they have no way to recover those costs? I guess. And is there somebody? I mean, there's somebody here, I guess, that would speak to that. I didn't realize he was, but that might be a question. But those are my concerns. And so what the amendment does basically is it just says that you start at the market value. You can negotiate whatever price you want below that. That's fine. And then the city has at least an opportunity to recover some of the other costs that they might incur in developing that property if they have to do some area assessment to get some new sewer and water in there, and there's different things that happen. There's all kinds of costs that cities would have in developing the property that they have no way of recovering under the way I think your bill is written.
Isn't it a part of the amendment?
Well, talking with my witness here, one of the things pointed out that maybe this would be okay, this language, if we also followed it with, or the cost, whichever is lower, the cost to the city. In other words, that same language there, or whichever is lower.
I mean, I think we're going the same place, but the other part of my concern is that all of the costs to the city are not captured in their acquisition. That's what I'm saying. And so I don't think a nonprofit developer should have to be more than the value of the land, but it's potentially feasible that a city could get way more than the value of the land tied up in getting it redeveloped. And what you're saying is, if it's just the acquisition costs, there's all kinds of other costs out there that the city could just have to eat, and it would really be an expensive. And I think it could serve as an actually to discourage cities from working with developers in a nonprofit situation to try and redevelop, because it's going to cost the city too much money. So I guess that's my concern. I think I like the bill. I think it's something we should be promoting, but that's my concern. I mean, if the cities are here, I wish they could speak to
us. We should hear from them.
I'm curious what Representative Peterson has to say first.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. I understand what he's attempting to do with the amendment, but by adding an appraisal, you're adding another $400 or $500 to the cost, which is driving it. Mm-hmm. Number two, the city's only going to acquire this thing out of tax forfeiture. I can't do anything with the domain anymore. So, I mean, it's coming to the public agency under duress.
Mm-hmm.
And chances are that's because somebody has abandoned it. So, I mean, trying to appraise it, and I know what you're trying to do, but you're driving, it's driving the thing the wrong way, is my concern.
What anybody
think? The amendment is driving it that way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson.
There's also a bill that Mr. Dabney, Representative mm-hmm. Dabney has, that allows abandoned homes and stuff for cities to step in, take possession, to stop the deterioration, and then turn on and work with different agencies to try to redo those homes. And I looked at this as a compliment to that. Maybe I should just shut up and let the cities talk.
Is there anybody from the city that would like to speak to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. It's an organization with 86 members in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about Senate File 357. Cities generally, in our organization specifically, support the provision of affordable housing, and we have for many, many years, and I hope we will for many years in the future. In the metropolitan area, the Met Council has established a goal of 51,000 additional units of affordable housing at 60% of area median income by the year 2020. 51 in an environment where we throw around huge numbers like billions, 51,000 can seem to be a pretty small number, but when you think about that a unit, each unit of housing at 60% of affordable or of area median income, it's a huge number for the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and we believe, frankly, that it's unattainable absent serious financial resources to assist with the provision of that housing. What happens is that absent those resources, and they're not going to be forthcoming, we're not going to have anywhere near the resources to create 51,000 units at 60% of area median income, individuals look to cities and counties and others to reform their regulations, to come up with a different way to try to deal with that gap. And it is often an easy way out, but the problem is cities will incur costs on these projects, and the gap is not going to be made up by regulatory reform. What we need to do is to increase those resources, and what cities need to do is to continue to grow the partnerships between the federal government, the state government, the Met Council in the case of the metropolitan area, nonprofit organizations, and cities, and work those partnerships in a way that we can all work together to provide affordable housing resources and get affordable housing built. We're afraid that Senate File 357 looks like a mandate to us, and we think that it is one, a disincentive for cooperation. I mean, if a city or county must transfer property under these conditions, I believe it will be a disincentive for those local government units to transfer that property to nonprofit organizations. The other side of the coin is that each one of these development projects comes with multiple funding sources and multiple circumstances, and the creative people that put these together come up with a variety of different schemes and techniques and different funding sources. Each deal is different. A city share may be infrastructure in one project, it may be land in another, it may be write down of their construction in a third, depending on where the housing finance agency money is, depending where the federal money is, depending where the municipal money is. And this bill, as well intentioned as it is, tends to lock out some of the flexibility that occurs as individual housing projects are being put together. So we're nervous about the mandate side of this bill. We're nervous about the reduced flexibility side of the bill, and we are nervous that it would actually serve as a disincentive to the creation of a lot of affordable housing that our Twin Cities metropolitan area needs. So with that, I will.
Thank you, Mr. Jamboy.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 13 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota. I start by apologizing to the author, to the committee, that frankly this legislation has been below my radar screen, and frankly most of the local government lobbyists that I've talked to since I became cognizant of this bill by reviewing today's agenda. the concerns that Mr. Janboy expressed are shared by myself. I primarily represent our organization in the tax committees and local government committees, and secondarily in the environment committees. And I want to concur that we share the author, I believe the committee's commitment to providing housing that is safe and affordable for those many Minnesotans who do not necessarily have the means absent governmental assistance. But this bill, frankly, is not the way to do it. First, although I'm not a developmental expert, I think I'm safe in saying that primarily the development or redevelopment that occurs in the state is front-ended by governmental entities, housing and redevelopment authorities, economic development authorities, port authorities, or they sometimes operate under other names, but they have the powers of those entities given by state statute. They usually are the entities that assemble the land for these projects. And that assembly of the land is not merely purchasing that land and holding it, then subsequently turning it over to a for-profit or non-profit entity. While they hold that property, they are responsible for securing the property, for maintaining the property at a bare minimum. That means that they have to take care of mowing the property, picking up the litter, shoveling the walks if there are such, and if it's a hazard, securing the property by putting up adequate fencing. If there is a structure on that property, they are responsible for boarding it up and making sure that it's secure, which is getting to be a more and more difficult proposition, I think, as many of the committee know, because of the high prices of copper and other metals that are being scavenged by some due to the high cost of those commodities right now. In addition, for many of the properties, we have obligations to either remove the dilapidated, abandoned structures, remediate the contamination on those properties, and the way the language reads right now, I do not believe permits those costs to be recovered. I will emphasize that frequently we do not recover those costs. We frequently write down the cost of those properties, but we're doing it via subsidies that are frequently financed either directly by the taxpayer or indirectly through tax increment financing. The second issue, the sentence down on lines 1.13 through 1.14, the requirement that we waive all development and other fees, Representative Eastland was right on point. Particularly for the HRAs, the EDAs, the port authorities, a significant portion of their funding comes from development fees that they elicit from their for-profit and non-profit partners. Absent those fees, they're either going to be able to do less, again, they're the main partner for assembling the land in the first place, or they will go to the property taxpayer for making up that difference. And that's a result we frankly do not want. In conclusion, again, we have significant concerns. I'm glad the bill is being referred to the local government committee because it does deserve the oversight of that committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Thank you for your testimony. I kind of figured the same thing, that some of these questions will be addressed in the next stop of this bill. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. Could you give me your name again and who you represent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moll, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of the five collar counties here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and eight of the larger counties in greater Minnesota.
Sure, sure. Thank you. And you know, we've all been out working late hours, and I probably on a normal day would have had difficulty understanding your testimony. It seems to me that this is a tool for local units of government and communities like mine that are having a very difficult time meeting their affordable housing targets. And we've established a target in the Bemidji area too, and any tools that we can provide for them. And kind of quickly, or as maybe small words as you can for me, just explain why wouldn't this be a success, just another tool, another means that our communities, which aren't college suburbs, I mean their inner cities, could use to, I mean, these properties are vacant.
You're
not yet generating taxes now.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moll, I think Mr. Jamboy's testimony somewhat addressed the issue. Each development is unique, and the mix of the resources that are used to make that successful varies from development to development. To the extent that it's a tax increment finance development, this may not be an issue, but to the extent not all development is tax increment financing. And we have to come up with the funds. Again, largely the land assembly is a governmental function. It is not for low income or moderate income housing, or at least government assisted low and moderate income. It is not the developer that frequently is doing that, at least for any large scale development. So we have to have the resources to come up with the dollars to do that. And as I said, we incur substantial costs for holding that property until that development occurs, which we may or may not recover depending on how each individual deals. But the second issue is the development fee. That is frequently a significant source of revenue, ongoing revenue, for the Community Development Agency, the Economic Development Agency,
Mr. Carlson,
the Housing and Redevelopment
Agency. I have a really good feeling about your opportunity to make your comments again in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad this is going well with government.
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I don't think that the East Amendment has actually been moved.
Oh.
So I would like to actually move. Is that right? We're just talking about it. We haven't moved it. I'd actually like to move an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that would strike the last two lines, 113 and 114. And also, I was talking with Representative Lane. She has some ideas. I just got an addition of a couple of words. And Kent, you could just remind me where those were, Representative. And I think this will take care of some of the major concerns that people have.
Well, the thought was, Mr. Chair, line 1.12, it ends, the cost to the county or city for acquisition, and then add, and other costs incurred in handling or holding the property. Something of that nature.
Time out here for a second. I want to speak to the A1 amendment that Representative Eastland brought up. I think, is that what we were discussing?
Yeah, I think I offered an amendment.
Well, did you offer it?
I think you did.
I misunderstood. I didn't think I
offered it. Yeah, so I think before we can act on this idea, we need to act on this amendment.
Can I speak to that?
You may, Representative Eastland.
I didn't know these guys were going to be here today. When I saw the bill, I read it, and basically, I guess, I had some concerns. I'm not convinced that my amendment does everything that needs to happen to the bill. And maybe what we need to do is work to do a fix before it gets to local government, rather than to try to fix it here and do it wrong. That would kind of be my thought. Because we can start rewriting on the fly here, but I'm not sure that my amendment was. I would have liked to have eliminated the last two lines as you just did too. But I still think there's a need to recognize the value, the full value of the property at some point, and then the city has the ability to negotiate anywhere they want from that position, and based on the way the deal is being put together, because the deal gets put together differently. And the city may be asked to put in they may waive some development fees, and so they'll need more money out of the, to recognize in the property. But they may not waive the development fees, and then they can do the deal for less. So I think the issue can get complicated, and I'm not sure writing it here would be the right thing to do. But that's my opinion.
I think what I heard Representative Eastland say is he's willing to withdraw his motion for the amendment and work with the author as it goes to local government.
I would do that, or encourage the author to work with. I would work with you and work with the city and the county people, and to try to come up with something that's amenable, so that
that's
we.
Fine with me.
We're good. So if we can do that, I'd withdraw my amendment.
Okay.
Done. Okay. The amendment is withdrawn. The bill is back the way it was initially brought to us. And it's, I think the motion is to pass it and send it to local government.
It is, Mr. Chairman. Sure. And I made the commitment not to take it in this form to local government. I'd like to actually talk to, with Representative Eastland and actually with the individuals here and come up with an amendment that would be appropriate before it's actually heard in local government.
Representative Peterson.
This year, if that happens.
I'd like to ask the author if I could. I liked your suggestion of the motion to delete the last two lines.
Okay.
And I would also ask that you go up to line 110. And right before the word transferring, put in the word willingly. So it would read, an agency or county or a city is willingly transferring the property to the organization. Because that's what it is. It's a willing buyer, willing seller. And it would seem to me that would take the angst out of it for both the city and the counties, because it's a willing transaction. And then you delete the last 113 and 114 as you're suggesting.
Mr. Chairman, if that's a motion, I'd like to make it.
Yeah. And okay. Take the angst out of it.
Okay.
So we do have...
And it has to also include taking the angst out.
We're still playing with this. And I think in front of us we have Peterson's amendment to this, which adds the word willingly after is on line 110 and deletes line 113 and 114. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
To that amendment, Representative Eastland.
Well, this isn't a point of whatever, but it's not necessary to the amendment. But I withdrew my amendment in hopes that we would not amend the bill here. that we would work together to find a solution before it went to the next committee.
That's a heck of an idea, and I'm going to encourage everybody in this room to work with it, because I'm sure those in local government will appreciate all of your efforts. So we are going to do nothing to this bill but pass it out of here with our blessing that it gets fixed before local government. That is the motion. And however staff wants to write that, you go right ahead. Okay? So those in favor of getting this bill out of here and sending it to local government, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Wonderful.
Aye.
It carries.
These are only informational hearings, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to ask the team to vote for both kind of important.
And the your bills?
They are.
Okay.
And they came in, but we don't have the actual number on them. They have been submitted for introduction. Mr. Chairman, the first one I would like to believe the committee has this. Okay. It's 073712, and I this is just an informational hearing again, Mr. Chairman, members, because the bill may be able to be moved forward, but at this point it's just for your information.
Representative Clark, please proceed with your
Mr. Chairman, basically what we're trying to do here is ensure that as work goes forward on the issue with Monticello and the all the issues that are happening there, that we want to make sure that we the health impacts that this committee has been looking at today a lot, but also in other days, that we have, again, our state agency helping us understand what health impacts might be from what is proposed to be done there. And I've asked Mr. Crockett to come forward and talk a little bit about what is happening there and why this is an important issue.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and your record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office, which is an organization that's been working since 1982, sort of on the relationship between energy development, the environment, economic development, and social justice, public health issues. How do those things relate or not as we work together to keep the lights on? And it was my organization, Mr. Chairman, that was sort of on the point that brought the Prairie Island issue to the legislature in 1994 that resulted in all of that mandating and moving forward with the energy agenda that we're now sort of reaping the benefits from in this session as we move forward with the global warming and the efficiency and the community-based energy development. So we've been at this work and looking at the nuclear components for it for a long time. We were intervening this past year as XL Energy came forward for the prospect of dry cask storage for nuclear waste at Monticello. The law reads right now that in the year following a commission decision, a public utilities commission decision to authorize dry cask storage at Monticello, the legislature has the authority to review, amend, or reject that decision in the year following that decision, which is this year. It is not likely, due to the tremendous amount of work on this agenda, on the energy agenda, that that will be done this year. There will be language introduced that attempts to extend that ability to review to next year. Its fate is uncertain. But there are aspects of that bill that are very, very important, that cut to the public health issues that that you have been addressing today. And one of those is monitoring of radiation at Monticello. And there are three points that I would like to really focus your attention on. The first is that it is uncontroverted that Monticello routinely releases radiation. All nuclear plants routinely release radiation. It is a fact of operating a nuclear reactor. In some years, it's relatively small, tens of curies. In some years, it's larger, hundreds or even thousands of curies per year. In some, it's even more than that. But they do release, they always release radiation. The second point is that we know from the National Academies of Science and their BEER, the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, the BEER reports, they're now in their seventh one, which was issued in 2005. We know that there are no safe levels of radiation exposure. In other words, every amount of exposure to radiation increases the potential for disease symptoms, for risks that include a wide variety of cancers, Down syndromes, and the rest of it. There is no safe dose. The third point is that the radiation monitoring, and this is where this language becomes important, the monitoring that is done at Monticello and at other reactors is not sufficient to tell us where reported release go. We don't know. There is monitoring. And the monitoring always and completely comes up negative. We don't know where it goes. The monitoring is not sufficient to tell us where it goes. And after all, we don't really care where it isn't, which is what the monitoring tells us. We need to know where it is, because that's where the human receptors may be. That's where the biological consequences may be. We know that, that of all of the thousands of curies that were released at Monticello in the first years of its operation, which amount to millions, fully 10% of that radiation of tritium, which has a half-life of 12 years about, is still actively circulating through the biological system. But you see, because we have no tracking, no monitoring to tell us where it goes, we have no factual basis to say that it's safe. There is no scientific information that allows us to say that those radiation releases are not causing biological and public health consequences. Quite the contrary. There is at least anecdotal evidence that they are causing adverse disease symptoms. And from our perspective, we think it's high time, considering that there is no safe dose, that there are these radiation releases, that we find out where it goes. And that's what this bill would help us do, is direct the public health department with the work of the utility to monitor with sufficient sophistication so that we can begin to answer the question, where do radionuclides go after they've been released from Monticello? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Croker. Any, what, I believe it's Mr. Croker, yes?
Crocker,
sorry. Any questions for the testifier from the committee? Representative Clark, any follow-up?
No, just that I have asked the health department to give me a fiscal note on what this would cost, and we're awaiting that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony today, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One more information hearing on some... a bill that is in process, Homeline Services, and I'd like to ask Beth Cuddleboy to come forward. Beth
Oh, okay. I guess there's two people here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We'll be brief, but I want you to have a chance to hear from them both. This is an issue that was brought to my attention kind of late here in the schedule, but I wanted you all to think about whether or not we should be addressing this in our final days here, and as we put our committee bill together, and I think probably talk about what the issue is with this, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cavalboy. I'm the executive director of Homeline. We're a statewide.
Say your last name one more time.
Oh, sure. That didn't come up smoothly. It's Cavalboy. I'm the executive director of Homeline. Homeline is a statewide tenant nonprofit that operates a couple of programs. One is the tenant hotline services, and the other is organizing and advocacy. I'm here today to talk about the tenant hotline services program. Homeline was founded on the belief that if you give tenants the tools they need, they can solve problems themselves. We started out as a program of community action for suburban tenants in 1992 with a free tenant hotline that anyone could call and find out their renter information. This is really seen as a need that we saw as unmet. There's nobody that helps the working poor, folks that just can't get those answers to help solve those basic questions. And a lot of our calls are around, how do I prevent stop an eviction? How do I get repairs made in my apartment? Real basic living condition questions that if they just get the straightforward advice and how to handle it, they can fix those problems for themselves. We've since expanded in 1999 to Anoka and Dakota. In 2001, we started serving Greater Minnesota and the East Metro area. And just last year, we expanded to serve St. Paul. So we've been doing a lot of one-time expansion, and we expect to take over 10,000 calls this year. And the nice thing about our services, I want you to let you know, is we don't just give information to folks. We track who's calling, where they're calling from, what they're calling about, and what happens to them if there's any follow-up. So we actually have information for everybody's district. If you ever need a report about what's the look of the renters and what kind of problems are they having in your district, we want you to think of us as a resource. So please feel free to contact me. Handing around just a general snapshot of the kind of calls we've gotten in the last 2 years, so you can take a look at that. And also our annual report. In the middle, it has our statewide tenant hotline. That's a free service. There's a phone number right in the middle on the bottom. Please give that to your staff. If you get calls from renters, we want to hear from them. We'll let Mike Brow talk real quickly about the tenant hotline.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give testimony.
Sure. My name is Michael Vraw, Vraw and Victor, R-A-A, and I'm the managing attorney at Homeline. I've been there for 10 years. Homeline tries to inform renters, whether it's a one-on-one phone call or high school classes, which we do several of every year. You'll notice in the last 2 years, we've talked to almost 5,000 students in the metro area about how to get an apartment, not mess it up once you're there. So we have fewer evictions, things like that. And we deal with people in one-on-one cases trying to prevent evictions, sometimes just through negotiations with the landlord, sometimes trying to get a landlord to make repairs if they aren't making. It's the kind of work we do. And we'll open it up for questions if you have any.
Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Moe.
Just a quick question. You said you received calls from Greater Minnesota, and I represent Bemidji over to almost Grand Rapids, and I haven't heard of you, and I sure would like to be able to get this information out to my constituents.
That's great.
Yeah, maybe just tell us a little bit more about the contact you do get in Greater Minnesota, and how might I just want to pass these out when I door knock, or...
Either one, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe. We get lots of calls from Greater Minnesota, some of which are interesting compared to the ones in the metro area we've gotten on renting a barn questions, which we don't get a lot of here in the metro area. So those are interesting, but no, we've gotten calls from Bemidji. Social workers tend to be our most likely referral source in Greater Minnesota. They've figured out who we are earlier. We've sent all the information to everybody in government, but I'm not sure it always gets read in that giant stack of mail that you get. But hopefully now that you know, you'll pass it on.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
How, Mr. Chair, and to testify, what's the organization of Homeline? I mean, how are you organized? 501c3, what are you?
I'm doing well. No, we're a 501c3.
Okay. And I was reading, I mean, you have a board that's made up of a variety of other organizations there. And what, I mean, you got a list of contributors as well. What kind of a I thought this was contributed, maybe not. But what? Yeah, funders. Yeah, there it is. What kind of budget do you have now?
Our budget, including the other programs that we're not talking about here today, is about $600,000. And about 260 of that is for the organizing programs. 340 is for all the tenant hotline services.
Okay. Mr. Chair, are there other organizations that do what you do?
Not really. I'll let Mike address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, there are agencies that do similar work. The two that come to mind are the Attorney General's Office, but they are the single largest referral source that we have. When a question gets too complicated or they feel like they can't really advise a renter, they send them to us. Legal aid would be the other most obvious comparison to us. The difference between us and legal aid, I think, are twofold. One, we don't have income requirements. The only requirement we have to help somebody is that they're a renter somewhere in the state of Minnesota. The other thing that legal aid has is a limit on topics. For instance, most legal aid offices won't work with renters when it comes to trying to get a security deposit back, which for a lot of renters, $300 means the difference between paying their other bills or fixing their car or something like that in a month. So we do all kinds of work that affect renters.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland.
Thank you. I guess, and the reason I ask the questions is because it's not, I think we normally like to not name the grant recipients in statute. I'm just questioning as to would it be appropriate to line 17 to change that to the Department of Human Services for a grant to a nonprofit 501c3 for the Tenant Hotline Service Program. I just think it's unusual. It's not maybe staff to comment on this, but I don't think we typically name the grant recipient in statute. And I'm just wondering if you're open to that. A lot of times they're written with a grantee in mind, and it doesn't, you know. And I think it's assumed that's where it's going, which I'm fine. But it just kind of.
I think it's a good idea, Representative Eastland, and I think when we finally do hear this panel, hopefully that will be reflected there.
I mean, it would be just a suggestion. We're not amending today, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. You know, I think this certainly could be written in such a way that we don't, but there was recently a report, I think, on this whole issue, and, you know, it's 50-50, I guess. It just depends. Sometimes we get into problems by not naming organizations that they have to go through a big, long process of figuring out a competitive process and then lose months and months of service. So, you know, it is a balancing.
Representative Lane?
I just want to say that when I did send out a mailing during my election to tenants in my area, I used some numbers for them to have access to it with an informational piece for them, too. And I had Homeline on there, and I checked out by personally calling different places to find out if they're still in business and what's going on. And it was basically Homeline, and like you say, the Attorney General's Office and Legal Aid, and that was it. The other things that I had, and I searched on the web, and the other things that I had from old numbers were no longer active. So this was it. And also, I do see that on your board of directors is Becky Fink from Rise Incorporated, and that's a good endorsement right there.
Exactly.
Yes.
As an Anoka County legislator, I can agree.
Mr. Chairman,
wonderful.
Thank you for that.
Representative Clark. Thank
you for that statement, and I just want to say I represent a very high percentage of renters, and this kind of resources is so important. Sometimes just getting accurate information is the most difficult thing, just to know what your rights are. So I have a great appreciation for this organization. They have a very nice, you know, very positive reputation in the community that I represent, and I think glad to hear in other communities as well.
Thank you for bringing this information to us, Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Members, I understand that we have some minutes to move, and I'm sure there will be no disagreement as the time on the clock would suggest. I need a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday and Wednesday. Representative Morgan, so moved. Excited to do that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Our minutes are approved.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
I just want to do one thing, which is to thank all the members today for hanging in here on Friday. We decided if we did the hearing today, we wouldn't have to have one on Monday, We'll see if that still holds true. We hope in terms of more bills, but we are pretty sure we're going to be backing up the bill, and then we will be. I think the next time we'll be meeting to be talking about the bill. And I'm still waiting for some actual input from some of my Republican colleagues. I don't know if it's we asked for it, and I haven't really received it. And I was oh, did you? Okay. Oh, excellent. Okay, the door is still open. We're still I just wanted to make sure that. I guess we'll see if y'all hear each other tomorrow at the session, and you can certainly come and talk to the session.
Representative Farland.
I wanted to clarify and say last night in higher ed, we heard that
members.
851, which is with the governor's bill that had the housing area in it. We found out that it was already in your work.
Chairman, let's just take a moment on that.
Representative Farland.
We did pull all of the language from the governor's bill. The question was very careful in doing it. We have all that language, and what we will be doing is, of course, looking at amending it, changing it, and so on. So I think we have it all. Right?
Wonderful.
And Mr. Weber, I think you are our
Representative McNamara.
Person on that.
Mr. Chair and Chair Clark, do you know when we might begin to see the bill, and then are your thoughts that you'll present it to give us an opportunity to take a look at it, and then just so that we can, you've been very good about amendments, and I appreciate that, and we've certainly been doing a lot of things on the fly and want to honor what your plan is, or don't you know it quite yet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, you know, we've been in negotiations a little bit with the leadership on this. We actually thought we would have it to you maybe even by the end of this week, but they asked us to hold back a bit because of the kind of backlog and a lot of work for some of the folks who are working on the various bills. So I believe that we will have probably, are we scheduled for Monday? Tuesday. I believe on Tuesday we will have a bill that we will look at and have a committee meeting. And, you know, it probably depends on working out the schedule with the other folks too, but I presume if we have something on Tuesday, we'll all have it and have a meeting as long as we need to.
I see some concern from the staff it might take a little bit longer.
A little longer? Okay, there you go.
We can be optimistic.
Okay, if you can just hang in there, I think we can talk a little bit more after the meeting with some of our staff, and I can maybe tell you more by tomorrow. Session, and so I want to be really fair. I mean, our staff has been working so hard, you know, and they have so many committees, and I know that we don't want to make it any more difficult than necessary, but I do want you all to have a chance to look at it.
So is that a matter? Mr. Chair and Chair Clark, so the thoughts would be like we might see the bill whichever day it is, and then we would act on it probably the next day. So would we get a chance to see the bill and prepare amendments, or we would have a chance, or are you going to present the bill to us and then we'll recess so that we could caucus and look at it? And then what about if we're not going to have it overnight, then amendments will just be in order for us to present, or what are your... I'm thinking it would sure be good if we had at least one day to look at it, because I would imagine it's going to be more than a couple pages long, and just the opportunity to review it on, and just the opportunity to review, I would think at least one day might seem reasonable.
I think if we can get it to you like the night before, you know, that would certainly be reasonable. And we'll have to make sure we can do that.
Through the night.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we've met through the night before.
So,
that's wonderful discussion.
What I'm trying to do.
This meeting is adjourned.